cannot take it anymore.
This is Rick Spip. No. I was going to make a Tran joke, but it's not funny anymore. Poor Chelsea Manning. We are going to talk about Chelsea Manning tonight. She has come out in her transitioned identity now. But we're going to have a great show tonight for a bunch of different reasons, not the least of which is Senator Mike Gravel, who you might remember. Senator Mike Gravel filibustered to end the draft. And that, of course, when Richard Nixon and the rest of the Nixon administration couldn't draft soldiers anymore, they couldn't wage the Vietnam War anymore. So Senator Mike Gravel ended the Vietnam draft. But the reason we're talking to him tonight is because of Chelsea Manning, formerly known as Bradley Manning. Senator Mike Gravel was the United States senator that saved Daniel Ellsberg's life. Senator Mike Gravel was the United States senator who bravely, courageously, amazingly, when Daniel Ellsberg showed up at his door with the Pentagon Papers, I don't know if you know the backstory, Daniel Ellsberg takes the Pentagon Papers out of the Pentagon. These are the papers that proved that the United States government was bombing Cambodia, bombing Laos, even though we said we weren't bombing other nations, showed that the Nixon administration had lied to the American people, had waged an illegal war. Any of this sounding familiar, except for, the part where the president lost his job? That part didn't happen. The other part that didn't happen was Daniel Ellsberg didn't go to prison for 35 years. Chelsea Manning now sentenced to 35 years in prison. For her role as the person who leaked some of possibly the most important truths to the lies we were told by our government under the Bush-Cheney years. And Senator Mike Gravel is going to talk to us about that night that Daniel Ellsberg showed up at his apartment with the Pentagon Papers, how he decided he needed to act in defense of Daniel Ellsberg. He spent 4 days locked away in his apartment with four attorneys, and they went through the Pentagon Papers and prepared them for Senator Mike Gravel to read into the congressional record. Once they were read into the congressional record, they would become the property of the American people and no longer classified. That story is amazing. I mean, he wanted to, I don't know if you've seen it. You know, ridiculously long documents. They talk about the WikiLeaks stuff. Incredibly long documents, the Pentagon Papers. And so Senator Mike Gravel had decided that he was going to need to stand and read them in the on the floor of the Senate, so he would need to get a catheter because he didn't want to have to urinate on the floor of the United States Senate. In the old days, the senators would just pee right there on the floor of the Senate when they were filibustering. It was like, well, this is what's important, boys. Got to stop you. The Republicans got wind that that sneaky Democratic senator from Alaska, that young whippersnapper who was a peacenik, was going to be pulling some shenanigans. So the Republicans didn't go to work the Friday he was going to read it. And they couldn't get a quorum in the U.S. Senate, so he couldn't pull his stunt of reading the Pentagon Papers. The story is amazing. It's phenomenal. We are going to talk a little bit about it, but we'll move on to talk about current events. One thing that did happen was after Senator Mike Gravel successfully read them in, and all the major news organizations, New York Times printed them in part, and other organizations printed them, Mike Gravel was charged with treason. Standing senator, charged with treason, charged with trying to destroy his own country, was tried in the United States Supreme Court, which is the only place you can try a standing senator, and found not guilty of treason. Why didn't any of this happen in the Manning case? Where's the Mike Gravel of our current Congress? Where are the people with the brass needed to stand up for someone who's willing to tell the United States, hey, guess what, the emperor's got no clothes? Anyway, so we'll talk to the senator a little later on tonight. We're going to have a lot of fun, but I did say I was mad as hell, and now I want you to know why. Just as the little fun music starting the show was playing, I went over to Google and I stuck my own name in, which if you don't do that very often, you're crazy. You should just throw your name in. You might be on a court document somewhere. It's always good to know. Just throw your name in. And the reason I was throwing my name in was I was trying to find the piece I wrote about the Gitmo hunger fast, and I wanted to find it really fast. So I put in Pat LaMarche and religion, and I figured it would pull it right up because that's how it's known on the Huffington Post website under the religion page. You know what came up? AOL Answers. What religion does Pat LaMarche embrace? What? Why does anyone care? Explore the latest questions and answers to What Religion Does Pat LaMarche Embrace? It's right here on AOL Answers. And it was only posted 17 days ago. Why in the world would anyone post that about me 17 days ago? And do you want to know who the advertiser is on that page? Pennsylvania Health Plans, Blue Cross, United, Aetna, and Cigna. Compare affordable health plans in Pennsylvania. Is that the strangest thing? But the best part of this whole thing, and honestly, Google your own name and see what's up there. The best part about this thing is related questions to What Religion Does Pat LaMarche Embrace? Related questions. Why don't cats have a smell? Another related question. Where do hornets go if not back to the nest at sunset? And my favorite related question. What is the diameter of the brake line for a 1971 Eldorado? These are the related questions that showed up on the same page with my question. Isn't that nuts? Okay, now that I've outed myself as a crazy egomaniac, I'll go back to the regular news. I was headed in tonight, and I take the bus from Carlisle to Harrisburg, and I really love it. And my favorite bus driver was on today. I love this guy. And there was an old, very fragile man on the bus. And I'd seen him on the bus other nights, but this particular night, he just looked very weak. And so when we got to this old man's stop, the bus driver got up, he pulled the bus over, he got up, he held the old man's hands, and he walked him off of the bus and over to the part of the sidewalk where he'd be safe. And I love that bus driver anyway, but I was just so impressed. It was just wonderful. So, Cat, that guy is great. I hope he didn't violate any rule that I just outed him for by, oh, he's probably not supposed to move his butt from the chair, but oh my goodness, he was so wonderful to this old man. And then we tried to get from Carlisle to Harrisburg. If you don't have a reason to do that, don't do it. If you're listening in Carlisle, don't leave. The Corvette show's in town. 5,000 Corvettes, according to Carlisle Events website. The place is going to be crawling with people. It's going to be great for business. It's going to be great for the local community. It's going to be great for all those restaurants that like to sell food to people from away. It's going to be great for all that stuff. It's going to be horrible for driving. Our bus trip was delayed about, probably took us an extra 40 minutes to get to Harrisburg today on the bus. So you really want to execute some sort of pre-decision making before you decide to leave Carlisle anytime too soon. Anyway, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about all kinds of things, like how about whether or not your kids should get a college education and be in debt for the rest of their lives over it. We'll talk about the president's new plan coming up after this.
The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Governor Scott Walker's Capitol cops arrested one person Thursday for merely clapping along with a solidarity sing-along song at Wisconsin's Capitol. The Daily Noon Hour protests started in 2011 during the Wisconsin uprising that was protesting stripping away of collective bargaining rights for public workers. A federal lawsuit over First Amendment rights at the sing-along at the Capitol goes to court for trial in January. Two Democratic Wisconsin state lawmakers stood with the solidarity sing-along on Thursday. Representative Sondi Pope was one of them.
I just feel I have the duty and the obligation to my constituents to be here and observe what's happening. As this administration chooses to try to suppress the people's voice, I want to be here to see it. Also, do not want this administration to feel that it can intimidate and silence the voice of the people.
Wisconsin State Representative Diane Hesselbein had a sign that said her office hours were right now during the sing-along.
I've been here the last few weeks, actually with my constituents, letting them express their opinions about what's going on in our state capitol. The Constitution speaks for itself. People are allowed to come here when they want to.
Holding up big letters that said unintimidated, the singers filled Wisconsin's rotunda with songs of protest.
Have you been to jail for justice, I want to shake your hand.
Labor singer-songwriter Ann Feeney, on a national Summer of Solidarity tour with United Steelworker activists and others, stood with the Solidarity singers and got a very warm reception as the singers sang their rendition of her song, Have You Been to Jail for Justice?
People didn't boycott the bus in Montgomery for a weekend. It took over a year of constant struggle. And I know that Wisconsin knows how to fight back. And you're doing it, and you're doing such a great job, and it's such an honor and a thrill to come back into the Capitol and see that you're still here. You're still here. So I'm so glad to stand in solidarity with you.
Lars Pripp is an ex-Marine member of Veterans for Peace. He carried a sign in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda that said, Political Prisoner Number 52.
I was arrested two times at the Capitol for being at the sing-along. And I'm here because it's a fight against fascism. The Capitol Police are taking political prisoners. I want to see people in the streets.
John Schultz is a retired United Church of Christ minister from Madison, Wisconsin.
And I'm here as a Christian pastor because I think that there are serious justice issues involved here. It's a moral witness, but it's informed by my faith and who I am as a Christian person. To free the oppressed.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Last year, 120,000 people over the age of 60 in the United States of America had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. It is a multi-generational crisis. And anybody who has, you know, sweated over their sons and daughters' student loan payments knows that it's not just about students. It's about all of us.
The American Nightmare has taken the night off. Rick Smith is with his family, according to, at points unknown. It's like when we had to hide Dick Cheney. You know, we're not really sure where he is. Probably an underground bunker playing with the children. And you're stuck with me. I'm Pat LaMarche. I'm very happy to be here, happy to be filling in, and happy to be talking about, well, actually I'm not. I've got two kids both saddled with student loan debt. I went to college not 800 years ago, actually about 35, and I got my student loans paid in about 6 or 7 years. What they did to our children in the meantime, it's just appalling. So Jane Watkus is a professor right here in the beautiful Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and she's going to join us right now. Jane, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Mm-hmm. So President Obama has a plan, and was he actually in the Commonwealth today?
Yes, he was. He was in the beautiful city of Scranton.
Oh, I love Scranton.
And I'll tell you what, I was so thrilled to be there because I was able to, my husband came along and two of our grandkids, the 8-year-old and the 10-year-old.
Now, I have to take you off the topic for just 1 minute and ask you if you're white.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. And did you get the feeling that President Obama hates white people?
Hates white people?
That's what the governor of Maine said this week, that President Obama hates white people.
Well, I can tell you.
Like his mother.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
So you didn't get that feeling at all?
Not at all.
Okay, good. Phew.
Oh, my Lord.
We do have a guest coming on later who's the first black producer of television in the United States of America who wrote a response to the governor of Maine about the fact that he hates white people. But anyway, so he doesn't hate white people. That's good. And he likes education?
He loves education. You know, he started his speech by talking about first-generation college students. And first-generation college students are close to my heart, I want to tell you.
Mm-hmm. What are you a professor of?
Of English.
Ah.
And I also American Studies. I teach about coal mining, literature, and lore, which is fabulous since we're living in what was, you know, the center of the universe when it comes to anthracite coal mining.
Yeah, Pennsylvania coal and West Virginia coal miners exempted from the draft in World War I because coal mining was so important.
Absolutely. I come from a coal mining family. And so when he started talking about first-generation college students, I really listened closely. He was talking about education really being the ticket to the middle class. in this country. And you know what? It still is. I see so many of my first-generation students who graduate and go on to get great jobs. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, it's a step up for their families. Their parents are so proud.
Right. Well, Jane, what about people like my kids? You know, I mean, I was a single mom. I didn't have a lot of resources to help them with. They both went to really great private colleges and got a lot of money. My daughter got $120,000 a year. John got even more than that.
Yeah.
And they still stuck with $30,000 or more.
Loans. Well, I think the president said the average loan, or the average that people have to pay back is $26,000. Mm-hmm. And I know of a lot of people who have to pay a heck of a lot more than $26,000 back.
My daughter's afraid to go to graduate school. She's and she's 27, and she's working a crappy job, and she can't improve herself.
So what's
the plan? Is there, first of all, is the plan just going to be for new kids that go to college, or is there something for the 20-somethings like my kids?
I certainly hope there's something. I mean, he did not go into a heck of a lot of detail about this, just that he had a plan. And he was hoping to get the other side of the Republican Party to sit down with him and make some progress in helping out. You know, it's college students, parents who are up against it, and a lot of the colleges really don't know what to do as far as student debt is concerned. I mean, listen, I have those students sitting in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want them to graduate with all that debt because it's going to take them a heck of a long time to pay it back. We know that. He even talked about he and his wife not paying off all their loans till they were, I think, in their 40s, mid-40s.
Well, then he can pay them now.
Gary, listen. He can write one check now.
Things are getting better. Things have looked up there.
Yeah.
President Obama. So the new deal – maybe that I shouldn't use that term, but the new gig is you're going to go to school and you're going to get your education and then you're going to pay a maximum every year for 10 years or something?
It seems like that. It seems that that's what, like I said.
Are we supposed to have to read tea leaves after a speech?
He wasn't too great with the detail.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
I was married to him.
I looked up the speech.
You did?
And I read it. Of course I did. You know, being the professor that I am, I have to do my research.
Right.
I looked it up, and I still can't find a heck of a lot of detail in this. I really can't. One thing that he also mentioned, which I think is, well, first of all, the location of the appearance in Scranton to me says a lot. You know, there are universities in Scranton. There are prestigious universities in Scranton. He didn't go there. He went to Lackawanna College, which is a two-year college, almost the equivalent of a community college.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was trying to make a point here that one has to start somewhere. And community colleges are a heck of a lot more affordable than private colleges, obviously, and state-supported universities. However, those teachers do a darn good job. And why not, if you have the opportunity, why not send your student to a two-year college? Well, most of the credits transfer now to universities.
I think these
articulation agreements.
Yeah, I think all those. Actually, I was having a chat last night with somebody. I was talking about Uncle John, who I love so dearly. He and my dad went into the military together in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
When they got out, my dad used the GI Bill to go and become a he ended up being the medical director at a big New England medical center.
Mm-hmm.
And my Uncle John became a plumber.
Mm-hmm.
I have never loved anyone in my life more than my Uncle John, and he had a comfortable existence.
Mm-hmm.
His family was middle class and comfortable, and my father was in this rat race.
Sure.
So one way or another, though, they both ended up, from absolute poverty through their educations, whether it was vocational school or, higher ed plus times higher ed. Every kid's not the same. Some kid may want to go and be, $90 to find out where the reset switch was on my garbage disposal. Mm-hmm. I'm no Einstein, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as long as every kid gets a chance to live to their potential and see what they want, all those schools should be funded.
Absolutely.
My question is, has anyone in any administration heard of Europe?
Oh.
I mean, why are we having these conversations about we're going to only saddle you with a crap load of debt instead of five crap loads of debt?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Why can't we have a real discussion about educating our kids?
Well, I think we do need to have a national discussion about educating our kids. And not only educating our kids in regard to college, but what about high school?
Yeah.
I mean, you read all these national studies about, you know, percentage of students state by state passing the test, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In Pennsylvania, it's the big standardized test, as mm-hmm. I'm sure it is, because of No Child Left Behind in many, many states. And what happens is the school districts become petrified
mm-hmm.
about this.
Right.
And they instill in the teachers this fear about, oh, your class had better pass the standardized test at a certain rate, or it's going to be bad, very, very bad. And not that I'm not a believer in tests. I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as one way to measure mm-hmm. tests are all right, standardized tests. However, this pressure takes away from learning. It really and truly does. I mean, our kids, I mean, we have wonderful students.
Plus, it encourages dropouts.
Yeah.
Because if you get a kid that's not performing well, get him out of the school.
Get them out,
yeah.
Because it hurts the school district.
And
it's
when they
drag it down.
Yeah, and when they had that only in Texas and not in the whole nation, Texas had the highest dropout rate in the country.
Yeah.
So then we elect president. Well, we didn't elect him. Sorry. He steals the election and he spreads this disease of his.
Mm-hmm.
This education disease throughout the country, and now we've got dropout rates going up everywhere.
Mm-hmm. 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 And in Pennsylvania, I can speak to Pennsylvania public schools, we have a governor that guts education funding, literally guts it.
He was told to by Alec.
Oh.
He was told to by the Koch brothers, who, by the way, laugh at him when he's not looking. They wouldn't invite him to their houses.
Oh, my God.
They just get him to do his dirty work.
When I think of the school districts and what they have to contend with, it just makes me want to weep.
Hmm.
Makes me want to weep.
So,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
We've got news threatened us now that, you know, the Senate's going to go Republican in the next election.
Oh,
that's the latest threat, right? Where's the left?
Mm-hmm.
And when what do we do as an educator? I mean, you're the people who are corrupting our children, right? What am I doing? I'm talking to you. I got you right here.
Yes.
You're the person. You're this liberal educator that's teaching kids to hate their country and everything, right?
Oh, yeah, right.
I mean, sure.
That's what I do. I stand in front of my American Studies class, and I criticize the country. Hey, just the opposite. I come from my grandparents were immigrants to this country,
mm-hmm.
and I grew up sitting at the kitchen table hearing, thank God we're in America.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's so wonderful here. We're just so thrilled to be here. Oh, my, we love America, you know.
Yeah.
And like most families, I had family serve in the military. You know, we had family members killed during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm an educator who stands before people, before classes, telling them to, you know, how lucky they are to live in America and get an American education. And when you have that American education, give back to the country. Run for office, for God's sake. You know, get involved in your local school board.
Run for office is so important. I had a wonderful teacher in college who said, every other teacher you get is going to tell you you have to vote. I'm going to tell you you have to run.
Oh, I tell them that. And, you know, I ran.
You did.
I ran at the county level. I almost won. I came damn close. But it was a fabulous experience. Got to meet so many people.
Mm-hmm.
And we need more women to get involved in running for office, by the way. Here's a commercial for women and young, you know, I have a young granddaughter, and I constantly talk to her about the importance of getting involved.
Can you imagine if we had young women? I also have run for office,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things, you know, the first time I ran for office, I had young kids, and I talked about daycare.
Yeah.
Second time I ran for office was many years later, and they were going to college, and I talked about student loans.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens. When you run for office, you talk about the things that you're experiencing.
Exactly.
If all you have is a bunch of rich, white, old men,
mm-hmm.
right, you don't get the broad spectrum of what.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was running when the kids were little, I said, you know, if I win, it's going to be a real challenge for me to serve.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no daycare at the Capitol.
No.
There should be. Young men and young women should be able to run for legislature because there's a daycare right at the Capitol that operates the same hours that the legislature does.
Mm-hmm.
And let's get some young families in there so that we fight young family battles.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, yeah, this is people are tired of me talking about this, but I do. I beat the drum for getting involved in politics. And one of the things that bothers me so much, I have discussions with my students, and a lot of times I mention politics, and the reaction is, that's a dirty word. Mm-hmm. Don't even say that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so I spend time talking about, it's an honorable public service
mm-hmm.
to serve.
Mm-hmm.
It's of the highest honor, you mm-hmm. know, that people should actually vote for oneself and put their faith in them. Oh, my God, that's a sacred honor. Oh,
it sure is. It's a treat to talk to you. I hope we can have you on the show more often, especially when I'm hosting. Cause,
I would welcome it.
Yeah.
This is the subject that's very close to my heart.
And let's keep you maybe in mind for a couple of weeks from now when the details get put into that bill, and then we can take another look at it.
I'd love to chat.
Jane Watkis, she's a professor of English and American Studies here in the fair Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Come from the cities and they come from the smaller towns. Beat up cars with the tires and drummers go crack, boom, bam. Honor of the game, the USA. Honor of the game, the USA. Honor of the game, the USA. Yeah, yeah. United in the USA.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Attention citizens, I have received inside information revealing that global terrorists are targeting us again. Their target is not Washington, New York City, or even Disneyland. Rather, it is Concord. You know, in New Hampshire, the state capital. Even though only about 43,000 people live there, Concord apparently has strategic significance, for the local police, fully backed by the city council, are preparing for a horrific terroristical assault. Specifically, they're seeking $258,000 from the Department of Homeland Security so they can gird themselves by purchasing a Lenco Bearcat G3 armored vehicle. This bold stand to defend the homeland was revealed by the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union, which obtained a copy of the grant request. Actually, it is not Al-Qaeda terrorists that have Concord's police gearing up for war, but, quote, the domestic type of terrorists. Really? In Concord? Yes, insist police, referring vaguely to daily challenges and warning that the threat is real and here. Who are these domestic demons? The police finger two groups, Occupy New Hampshire, whose violence has mostly been in the form of doing litter pickup days, and the Free State Project, a libertarianish outfit trying to convince 20,000 like-minded people to move to New Hampshire. Neither group is armed or dangerous, and both are committed to nonviolence. Yet the police claim they need a Bearcat G3 to respond to terrorism involving, quote, chemical, biological, and radiological materials, as well as explosive gases. This is Jim Hightower saying the most explosive gas in this case is coming from police officials who have tagged their own peaceful citizens as terrorists. And the real threat to our security is the Department of Homeland Security, which keeps shoveling our tax dollars into the militarization of police forces all across the country.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Oh, one lie leads to another two lies, covers the other three lies. Now you're in an awful fix. Four lies, you're getting in deeper. Five lies, piling up steeper. Get wise, or you're going to be telling me.
So two lies don't make a truth? Oh, well, that's going to be bad news for the poor little folks down there in the Congress. I want to talk about Chelsea Manning, formerly known as Bradley Manning. I wrote an piece for Alternate that was in yesterday's Alternate when he got his 35-year sentence, saying that if President Obama would take a year of his sentence, I'd take a year as well. I'd actually take a year even if President Obama won't take one, because I don't think he would. Someone said I was disingenuous because it's not possible for me to take a year. You know, it may not be possible. It doesn't mean I wouldn't do it. I'm grieving the fact that this guy told us the truth about our illegal war, and he's being punished for it. The saddest thing would be if he thought Americans actually cared. If he did it and said nobody's going to care, but it's the right thing to do, okay. But if he did it and said, oh, Americans are going to say, yeah, this is, we're going to quit that, yeah, then that would be really sad. Joining me right now is a hero of the United States of America, certainly one of mine, and I know an awful lot of people who, the minute I say this guy's name, the first thing they say is, I took one of those tests when I wanted to figure out who I should vote for president, and it said Mike Gravel. Of course, Senator Mike Gravel. Hello, Senator. Welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hey, glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining. You're out in sunny San Francisco, so
it's not so sunny right now. Oh. But, no, we're south of San Francisco, a place called Burlingame.
Oh, okay. We were the Rick Smith Show, myself included, we were out there on a rapid fire trip through the United States, and we went from San Jose to Vancouver, Washington, one day.
Wow, that's a long drive.
It was a long drive. And we took an hour to stop at Crater Lake. So part of it wasn't just going back and forth. It's actually going up and down, too.
Yeah.
Senator, you are the man that, I'm obviously very fond of you, and we've known each other a long time, and so I'm not telling you any secrets. But you, in my opinion, are responsible for the end to the draft that cost the lives of so many U.S. soldiers, filibustering to end the draft. And then, of course, what we want to talk about now, your role in the Pentagon Papers and protecting Daniel Ellsberg for his courage. And that wasn't an easy thing to do.
It was an interesting thing, event at the time.
Yeah, give us just a little history lesson on, I mean, hopefully some of the people listening weren't even alive then. Hopefully we've got some young people who are going to get an education now. What was the set of events? And I'm asking you a question I already know the answer to. But Daniel Ellsberg gets the Pentagon Papers.
Well, I can be more precise than that. Okay. Ellsberg decides to copy the papers, having gone through a cathartic effect of being for the war and now being opposed to the war in Vietnam, and so. He acquires the papers, tries to get Bill Fulbright, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, to take the papers and make them public. Now, the papers were a study that was commissioned by Robert McNamara to find out how the United States got involved in Vietnam. And so it was the history of this event,
mm-hmm.
and that's what it was. Now, McNamara, after he had read it, it was classified top secret and it was put on a shelf. And it was only later when Ellsberg realized that that should be something that should be released to the public, and hopefully would help bring about shortening the war.
Now, why would how we get into the Vietnam War shorten the war? Because people learned that It was
well,
not
what
true.
They learned was that they were lied to by three separate presidential administrations, meaning the president and his administration. He personally obviously had to have lied with respect to Southeast Asia and our involvement in Indochina. And that's what it is, the history of how we got there. And so what we thought, and many still do think, that because these were lies by the government, that the people would react very strongly. And, of course, they did with the younger generation. And that's what I think brought about a shortening of the time and a shortening of the war.
Now, you know, I always say that there's no fun in being right when you're right about something that's bad. I mean, I didn't believe the yellow cake from Niger. I didn't believe the crap that I felt that the president and vice president at the time, Bush and Cheney, were feeding me. I didn't believe it. And so when it turned out that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and, oh, by the way, if there had been, we would have sold them to them, but that they weren't. And all that, there was no fun in being right. You know,
it's painful to be right.
Yeah.
And it exacerbates the pain, because then what happens, you focus on the absolute injustice of the loss of life that has taken place.
We're speaking with Senator Mike Gravel. Now, so we get WikiLeaks telling us basically the exact same thing, in many cases anyway. The stuff you heard was lies. We know the Valerie Plame thing blew up, but nobody cared. You know, Scooter Libby takes a fall, blah, blah, blah. So Bradley Manning releases video of, among other things, and documents, among other things, showing basically a turkey shoot of unarmed civilians by U.S. soldiers who are bloodthirstily begging to kill. Everybody's mad. Well, not everybody. There are huge Bradley Manning supporters, and Chelsea Manning supporters. But the people who are arresting him and putting him in jail and solitary confinement and torture and locking him up for 35 years, nobody's really giving them a hard time about that.
That's the tragedy that the American public hasn't really woken up to. No, there's a pervasive sense that they know the injustice, but that pervasiveness is cautioned by the fact that, you know, your vote doesn't count. What you do is not going to be meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Will there be an event, Pat, that all of a sudden will crystallize something and it'll be explosive, and before you know it, we will have the changes that we're looking for? But I don't know when that event's going to come.
Is there you've seen a lot of corruption in government, unfortunately.
Well, the process is a corrupt process.
Mm-hmm.
Stop and think. You raised money from special interest to get yourself elected, and then obviously you go ahead and represent that special interest rather than the other interest, because you've already persuaded yourself that that's the right course.
The current president of the United States, you know, I can't remember a happier day in my political career, and I just loved seeing in January 20th, 2009, seeing that black family walking down the street. I was so proud of the United States of America. I was like, oh my God, we're not bigots. We're not racists. Is this possibly true? And this, every day from there on in, he just started devolving into exactly what his opponent would have done, except we weren't allowed to criticize him. We could have criticized McCain. We could have criticized Romney, but we're not allowed to criticize the president.
Well, not only that, he is so smooth in the way he speaks and his presentations and his sincerity that he gets away with even more than that. But that's changing. That is changing.
How about the back in the Nixon days, and poor Nixon, if there is an afterlife, he must be going, wait a minute, what happened? my job back. I didn't do anything so bad. And I cared about OSHA. But is there a way that there would have been drone strikes of suspects in other countries that just nobody would even have talked about impeachment? I mean, they're talking about impeaching President Obama because they call him a socialist, which is absolute absurdity. But I don't hear anyone saying, you know, this is way beyond his scope of power to be having a kill list and then executing it.
That's right. And that clearly is, you know, would be an international crime, a global crime, and totally immoral. And says a lot that Obama would put himself in that position.
In my piece that I wrote for Alternate, I said, if he's being told to do this by corporate interests that have purchased him, why doesn't he just wear a wire?
I saw that. And I,
couldn't he just rat him out?
I had to say, pardon me?
I said, can't he just rat him out?
But he doesn't want to. He's one of them. This is what we failed to realize. There was such hope because of the racial issue. Mm-hmm. But what we elected was a person every bit as conservative as the Bushes. Well, they'll do certain things that please liberals and should. But as far as what he's done in this administration, it's horrible. The only thing Obama will be known for in the future is the fact that we elected a man of color to the office of president.
Yeah, nothing. I mean, even his signature legislation, the Affordable Care Act, he has now backed away from. And I never trust something that the insurance companies like.
Oh, rightly so. And why should the insurance companies be involved? This is a health care issue. Mm-hmm. We're only using them so that they can make money and a profit. And of course, who pays for this is the general public.
Now, is there anything that can be done on behalf of Chelsea Manning? Is there anything that can be done?
Yes, I think there should be. Well, first off, let's just hope that he'll be able to get the peace award.
Oh.
Let's see what happens in Norway. That decision's made in October.
Oh, that would be magnificent.
Oh yeah, that'd be well. It'd be a way for them to reintegrate themselves after giving Obama a peace award for doing nothing.
Right. For being elected. He literally got the Nobel Peace Prize for being elected. Yeah.
Well, he had only been president for less than 10 days when his name was submitted, and because there's a deadline. Mm-hmm. I think it's 1st of February. There's a deadline to submitting your proposals. And so here, he hadn't done anything, he just got elected. And you're right. So he got the Nobel Peace Prize for getting elected.
Now, if Chelsea Manning, I'm really trying to honor him, her, on that one.
I didn't catch that, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah. And I'll try to do the same thing myself.
If Chelsea Manning were to get the Nobel Peace Prize, that would have to shock the world community the way it did when that Chinese dissident did, maybe not last year or the year before, to be sitting in a prison and getting the Peace Prize.
Yeah, and I think it would not only would it get him the prize, you know, he'd have over $1 million that he would also be able to capitalize. By writing a book, and you know, just the whole area, I think, of him getting the Peace Prize would be an embarrassment to the American government, the American military.
Is he in jail because he ran up on stage and pulled the United States of America's pants down? Because I mean, they say that literally. I mean, even that collateral murder video that ended up being part of an Academy Award nominated documentary hasn't had any effect, you know. So they attribute no. Some people say that's because it's classified, but they attribute no collateral damage to the release of the documents.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. That's a hoax that was used.
Mm-hmm.
No, he released information to prove that the government overclassifies. And, of course, and everything is classified in the interest of national defense. And, you know, and of course, it doesn't add to the national defense. It damages the national defense. When we go to war like we did in Iraq without provocation, there's no way we can ever recapture the moral high ground of any part of world leadership.
If you don't mind, I want to ask you a question about something I didn't ask you. I could ask you about. today there were two rulings that came down. Nidal Hassan was convicted of the Fort Hood killings, and he awaits his sentence now, which could be the death penalty. And then the gentleman, I don't have the story in front of me, the gentleman who slaughtered the people in the two villages in Afghanistan was sentenced to life in prison today.
Yeah.
So those two things happened today, and I'm just curious what kind of a message we send when first of all, I'm against the death penalty. I'd really rather they didn't throw it around anyway, but we do have the death penalty hanging over the head of the guy who killed the Americans, saying he wanted them to stop killing people, Muslims. And then we don't have the death penalty for the guy who went absolutely off his nut and shot up little families. I mean, does this stuff not matter in the world community, or are we naive in thinking that it doesn't?
It does matter, but it's something that is historically absorbed by the subconscious of people, and all of a sudden, an event can happen, and you can have an explosion, and before you know it, what you wanted is in the course of happening.
Mm-hmm. And the drone bombings, are they?
God.
Yeah.
I can't think of one of the problems of the Vietnam era is when these pilots were captured, and it just marvels over the fact that dropping all these bombs on these people, killing innocent civilians, that they would be bothered to capture and keep them alive. Yeah. Obviously, some were killed in the process, but others were captured, like McCain, and spent a great deal of time more than 5 years as a prisoner of war.
Mm-hmm. Which is why he can't move his arms in full.
Yeah, because they were broken, I think, at the shoulders a couple times.
So this is the purpose of drone bombing, so they wouldn't take our pilots prisoner?
The drone bombing now?
Yes. Is that the argument behind it? We just don't?
No. In no way they make that argument. It's just that we've got to kill the leadership, the head of the snake, so that we are safer, because that snake is eventually going to send people over to the United States and create terror on our shores.
So we don't have any need for the justice system anymore. We don't have any need of charging people and having a trial.
At least for the foreigners. Now, it's still a difficult situation with the United States as long as you got a grand jury around. But for the foreigners, no, there's no justice in that regard.
It seems the only people who even have done anything about some of the atrocities of the last decade and a half are people from Canada or old Europe. Dick Cheney and the president, former President Bush, having to cancel trips to Canada and Western Europe, Donald Rumsfeld, because there are people who would arrest them. Are we looking forward to that for President Obama as well?
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Once he leaves office, there's just too much that's gone on with Guantanamo, the continuation of these secret prisons around the world. Stop and think. We still have these rendition sites, Pat. And when they say, "Oh, but we don't torture," Hell, if you don't know what's going on and it's secret, you can count on it. There's going to be torture of prisoners.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just throw my hands up in anger over the situation, that it just continues and gets worse.
Senator, what happened? I mean, you know, I used to think of Buchanan and Polk, you know, as these soulless human beings, the unenlightened leaders in an unenlightened time. And I thought, you know, maybe we'd have enlightened times and then we'd get enlightened leaders. We've got these. It's just, what's the difference? What's the difference with invading Mexico and slaughtering the Mexicans so we can steal Texas, or, you know, or slaughtering the Indians, the Native Americans? What's the difference? We haven't grown up.
No, we haven't, and we are really a very bloody people, and so what's happened to our culture, it's been militarized, so that, you know, we've got to support Du Bois. Well, what's really tragic is they come back sick, they come back at a suicide rate unseen before in our history.
Mm-hmm.
They come back because they've been damaged morally. And once that happens, you've got a problem on your hands.
When you advocated for Daniel Ellsberg, and when you put yourself in the way of people who tried to hold him accountable for telling the American people the truth, were you called names? Were you maligned? And are you more maligned now?
No, I'm certainly not more maligned now. There's an advantage to getting older. You bury a lot of your enemies. No, I'm not maligned now, but I was then. There's no question about it. Gerald Ford and Hugh Scott and some others tried to see if they could censure me in the Senate, and Mike Mansfield stepped in front of that bullet, and I was protected as a result of his leadership in that regard.
Where are the Mike Revels today?
Well,
and the Mansfields and the.
Yeah, well, first off, you've got in mind that you've got a Congress that is totally, totally sycophant to the military-industrial complex, and to sustain that, you've got this web of secrecy in the government. Now, you've got Ron Wyden, Udall from Colorado, and Rand Paul to a certain degree, that they seem outspoken in this area. But the biggest problem that they face is that if they were to officially release documents as I did,
mm-hmm.
They would have some real problems with the leadership, which is not the leadership that I enjoyed when I was in the Senate.
Yeah, you were backed to some degree, at least. How about Henry Kissinger? He must have been kind of annoyed.
Oh, worse than annoyed. He's the one that coined the phrase about Dan Ellsberg, that called him the most dangerous man in America, because Ellsberg knew Kissinger very well. He worked for him for a while. He worked on some reports. So they knew each other very much better than I knew. Well, I didn't know them at all when this all happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, today, I believe it was audio tapes, the last of the audio tapes from Richard Nixon's time in the White House were released today, I believe it was, today or yesterday. And a headline, Washington Post headline, I can't believe this is a headline. This is like a headline, RAIN! Look up, clouds, rain, or some other thing that's apparently falling on your face. The headline said, Cheney and whom else? Cheney and, H.W. Bush and Cheney in the Nixon White House. Daddy Bush was the head of the committee to reelect the president.
Of course he was. And he was reported by, given the head of the CIA.
Right. He became the head of the CIA. And then Reagan, the other one, they were shocked.
Well, we said no. He sent him to China. He was the ambassador, the first ambassador in China.
And then, unfortunately, but not surprisingly, the Chinese sent him back.
yes.
And then Ronald Reagan, also a big surprise that Ronald Reagan's on the tapes, except that he was governor of California at the time.
That's right. That's right.
Doesn't the Washington Post know this stuff?
Did the Washington Post know this? Oh, yes. There's no question in my mind.
I don't understand. It's almost like these news stories that come out are told to people rather than saying, of course you should understand that the power elite that's in charge is the same one that was in charge when the president was disgraced. It's like, oh, son of a gun, look. George H.W. Bush was in the Oval Office. The news, it's remarkable.
Well, I can't disagree. I just can't disagree. One of the problems with the news is they want to be entertainment. They want to get your attention. So they come up with a whole host of this celebrity fluff to occupy the listener's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so it all becomes a cult of celebrityness.
Yeah. Well, you're my celebrity, Senator. I just think you're fabulous.
You're biased.
I know I am, but I'm also always right. So it works out nicely.
Well, I agree with you on that.
Hey, one last thing. Real quick, we have about 2.5 minutes. I just want you to real quickly talk about how you kept talking about we have a corrupt system. You believe and have been supporting a system that could help the United States get itself righted again. Is that too much to put into 3 minutes?
No, I can do it quickly. what she's talking about is a solution to the problem that we face today. And what we realize is that representative government, from the get-go, from when it was first designed in Philadelphia, from the get-go has not function very well for the benefit of the general public. Now, we've made advances over the period, but not what could have been had the structure been somewhat different. And the structure is one of representation. What I've been working on is a structure where the people are the ones that also can make laws like their representatives who now have a monopoly on it. And so if you look at the problem, there's two venues. One is the government, wherein lies the problem, and the other venue is the people. For the people to be able to act, they must have the tools to be able to make laws. Marcus Cicero said 2,000 years ago that freedom is participation in power. Power in our system of government is legislating, making laws. Therefore, if the people are ever to be free in our society, they have to become lawmakers. And I have legislation on a website that can do just that. And that website is ncd.us.
ncd.us.
NI4D
also, right? NI4D.
Yeah, NI4D or NCID.us.
Okay,
and that's National Citizens Initiative for Democracy.
And for states like Maine, and I don't believe it is true of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but for states like Maine who already have a citizens initiative for their state, this would be a citizens initiative for the entire country. Which would
correct.
Allow
and it
us
would
to
be,
make
and it would be uniform, and it would it'd be a lot easier than it is to do initiatives in Maine today.
We're going to put links to NI4D and NCID up on the Rick Smith Show webpage. Senator Mike
Great.
Gravel.
I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, Patricia, anytime.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I'll talk to you later, Senator. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. It's Friday, and we'll be right back.
90% of the wealth, 10% of the people, own 90% of the wealth, where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself, 10% of the people, own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Governor Scott Walker's Capitol Cops arrested one person Thursday for merely clapping along with a solidarity sing-along song at Wisconsin's Capitol. The daily noon hour protests started in 2011 during the Wisconsin uprising that was protesting stripping away of collective bargaining rights for public workers. A federal lawsuit over First Amendment rights at the sing-along at the Capitol goes to court for trial in January. Two Democratic Wisconsin state lawmakers stood with the solidarity sing-along on Thursday. Representative Sondi Pope was one of them.
I just feel I have the duty and obligation to my constituents to be here and observe what's happening. As this administration chooses to try to suppress the people's voice, I want to be here to see it. Also, do not want this administration to feel that it can intimidate and silence the voice of the people.
Wisconsin State Representative Diane Hesselbein had a sign that said her office hours were right now during the sing-along.
I've been here the last few weeks, actually with my constituents, letting them express their opinions about what's going on in our state capitol. The Constitution speaks for itself. People are allowed to come here when they want to.
Holding up big letters that said unintimidated, the singers filled Wisconsin's rotunda with songs of protest.
Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand.
Labor singer-songwriter Ann Feeney, on a National Summer of Solidarity tour with United Steelworker activists and others, stood with the Solidarity singers and got a very warm reception as the singers sang their rendition of her song, Have You Been to Jail for Justice?
People didn't boycott the bus in Montgomery for a weekend. It took over a year of constant struggle. And I know that Wisconsin knows how to fight back. And you're doing it, and you're doing such a great job, and it's such an honor and a thrill to come back into the Capitol and see that you're still here. You're still here. So I'm so glad to stand in solidarity with you.
Lars Pripp is an ex-Marine member of Veterans for Peace. He carried a sign in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda that said, Political Prisoner Number 52.
I was arrested two times at the Capitol for being at the sing-along. And I'm here because it's a fight against fascism. The Capitol Police are taking political prisoners. I want to see people in the streets.
John Schultz is a retired United Church of Christ minister from Madison, Wisconsin.
And I'm here as a Christian pastor because I think that there are serious justice issues involved here. It's a moral witness, but it's informed by my faith and who I am as a Christian person. To free the oppressed.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
That's why I started giving these speeches. My job is not only commander-in-chief, but educator-in-chief. And I needed to say to the people, you bet it's tough.
I needed to make these speeches because I'm the educator-in-chief. I'm not just the commander-in-chief. See, it was really funny when I got to be commander-in-chief because I was a cheerleader in college. I spent so much time cheerleading in college, and I was kind of thought of as, well, kind of like a little bit of maybe a dandy. So I thought, well, when I get my hands on an army, I'm going to kick some sweet, good old-fashioned, I don't care where it comes from. But... And then I did that, and boy, then I had mission accomplished in about 11 minutes, so then I had to move on to the education system. And I've done to the education system exactly what I did to Iraq. No infrastructure. I'm sorry, that was George Bush. He had to leave. That was not me in any way disrespectfully pretending to be the former president of the United States, and actually, quite frankly, I have a little chip on my shoulder about that. Because he wasn't president. He was not elected. He wasn't elected in 2000, and then when I ran in 2004, my running mate David Cobb and I proved he was not elected again because he lost Ohio in the recount. But, of course, John Kerry couldn't. No, all right, I'm ranting. So much for that. But we are educating tonight because we have educators with us. And we have educators who did something that actually my own children have done, and so it's kind of exciting and fun for me to talk to them. Jay and Ashley Newhart are here. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
They are educators who decided to take their native English-speaking talents to another part of the world. And actually, you took it to the first world, which was really smart. John went to Mongolia and ate rat. You guys went to Japan and brought your ability to speak English and teach English to the kids of the Fukushima Prefecture.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. So you went there 3 years ago?
Yeah, it was about 3 years we spent over there. And,
so let's go what it was like right up to the day before the tsunami, or even like the week before the tsunami, because I don't know if there were warnings of the tsunami. But what was life like? Was it just, you know, you're having these new cultural experiences, everything's great, stuff's really cool, and then and you're doing it for a year or so and you're thinking, I like Japan? I mean, tell us what that was like before all the other things happened.
Of course, absolutely. I was especially just in love with the country so much from day one, pretty much. We got there in August, which is actually into the school year. We missed the first semester of the school year due to the people that we were replacing staying a little bit extra to finish a master's program. But we came in over the summer break, and the country is just absolutely beautiful, and the people are so wonderful, and the food is amazing. I just can't sing the praises of the culture of Japan enough.
Okay, so if I try to think about what I've seen from Japan and guess, I can tell you maybe kind of the shape of Fuji, right?
Okay. And, to start.
Yeah. And I could tell you maybe some downtown Tokyo street kind of crowdedness is in my mind. And some really cute apartments. Like, I'm thinking stuff that comes from IKEA for the apartments.
Yeah, we were 4 hours north of Tokyo. So we were away from the hub of Tokyo. We hadn't seen Mount Fuji yet. We were out in just beautiful hills with lots of trees and rice paddies. It was a very peaceful...
trees and rice paddies?
Trees on the mountains, rice paddies on anything that was flat.
Huh. So there's a lot of water.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an island nation.
Yeah, right? It's an island. But, yeah, there's water in the rice paddies for the beginning part of the growing season, and then it dries up as the rice gets taller and stronger. And it's just a very peaceful, beautiful place out where we were.
So what were the kids like? Were these kids farmers? This is a rural area, you're saying. So what were your students like?
Largely, yes. The area we were in was a smattering of towns out in the middle of nowhere, pretty much. So a lot of the kids' families were pretty much straight out of rice farming. There was also a lot of tobacco being grown in our area, too, which is a major export of the Fukushima area. And
tobacco.
Also well-known for peaches, which was surprising because it was kind of north and had cold winters and everything. You think of Georgia peaches,
yeah.
I would think it'd take warmer climate to grow them very well.
Yeah, well, Pennsylvania peach is the best I've ever had. I go like nuts. Have you guys been down to Hollabaugh Farms yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Oh, you're in for a treat. When you head to Gettysburg, Hollabaugh Farms, incredible peach orchards. All around there are other farms, too. That's the one that I really like to go to. So you get there, and you're in this, and you came from upstate New York?
Yes.
And were you trained to be, did you go to college for English, or, I mean, what was your background?
I went to college for art education, and I taught for 2 years in the U.S.
So did you learn to do some Japanese art while you were over there? I mean, some of that stuff's beautiful. Is it watercolors and, you know?
Yeah, I got to meet a Japanese potter and talk with him about making pottery and working with wood fire kilns, and I traveled to two of the historic centers of ceramics, and that was a lot of fun. I also took a class in some textiles, and that was also great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, textiles. And actually, Japanese fabrics now, it's a huge business in the United States. You go online, and you can get them painted different ways. And
yeah, there are a lot of things that look Japanese, but also there's a lot of quilting fabrics and different things that I discovered there's a huge center for in Tokyo, and it's a lot of fun. It was great to just immerse myself in a huge fabric center.
And you guys relocated to Carlisle basically because you wanted to find a nice place in the United States that you wouldn't have to shovel snow, was my understanding.
A number of reasons. We were looking for a nice spot to land in the Northeast, so Carlisle seems like a good place to to land, and that's where we went.
And real quickly, I want to thank you guys for being my first in-studio guests. This is really fun. And you sound great, so all the sounds are going good. So you're just before we go back to Japan, Ashley, you're an artist still. You make jewelry. You have it in shops around the area. How's it being received?
It's pretty new here yet. I've just gotten it in into the American Artisans Gallery in Carlisle about a month ago, and I'm going to be at the first Friday for September 6th. I'll be in front of Artist Market on Pomfret Street, so come on out and see me there.
Yeah, neat. So, and you guys have motorcycles, which was very handy, because was the traffic still awful with those ridiculous Corvettes?
No, not at all.
Oh, my God. I was on the bus coming in from Carlisle, and we, like, went off-roading. The bus driver was like, I'm done. I am so done with this traffic. It was crazy.
No, it's a piece of cake. We're looking forward to the parade tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, that is really. And I say ridiculous Corvettes only because all those guys have the same car.
No.
No, really, they do. I'm like, hey, you know what, you guys, they're just the colors are different. It's the same car.
Pretty close.
5,000 of the same car. You go to the parking garage.
I'm going to have to disagree with you guys on that one. I'm very excited to see every single one of them.
Okay, good. And see, that is the point of this car show, right? It's just amazing. But when they do the other car shows, like it might be the Chrysler show, and there are like 78 models or 1,000,000, 1,200 models of Chrysler, and then all those other years they used. And no, it's just a Corvette. And so it's really kind of wild.
I think you're ranting again.
Oh, yeah, okay. And they're all driven by men who really wanted that car 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, those are fireworks. You might be able to hear the fireworks. We're right near City Island where they have a baseball game every night that I'm here. So I ducked for cover the first couple of times. Okay, so you're in Fukushima and you're traveling a little. You're getting to teach the kids. How well do they speak English?
Being out in the country, the English is actually quite poor. It's a lot better when you get into the city, so we could ask people for directions when we were down visiting in Tokyo and when we went on trips into Osaka and Kyoto and places like that. But up where we were, the kids don't have a lot of motivation, being that they are from farming families, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are going to continue in that. And you don't have to be terribly ambitious in your foreign language studies. Out in the country.
but all the clothes are in English and all the, you know, and all the MTV stuff.
It's very trendy, actually. Yeah. It's a lot like the Chinese characters here in America where, you know, people will get tattoos mm-hmm. and then they actually wonder, you know, is the tattoo that I got actually, you know, what I think it's supposed to say, which in a lot of cases it really doesn't. For example, a friend of ours was on a train when we were in Japan, and a guy had some nice, beautiful kanji written on his arm, and what it said was, library. And they asked him about it. They said, do you realize that your arm says library? And the guy, you know, had to come up with a quick defense. Oh, yeah, but I just thought it was really beautiful, you know. So
that's a pretty word, now that you mention it.
In kanji, it's gorgeous. It is.
That is really funny, you know. Like, I want it to say Baba, but it says, you know.
Right. So in Japan, it's the same kind of thing with English, where it's cool to look at and it's cool to wear on a T-shirt, but the grammar, and it just doesn't make sense at all, and it's quite ridiculous.
Huh. So how did they receive you as Americans? I don't know. I mean, we've got, you know, all kinds of things this is still a pre-tsunami. There's all this history, for want of a better term, right? Some of it kind of unpleasant. And yet, in a matter of decades, we're their best friends. So how did the people feel about you guys coming to town?
We were pretty much in the best friend mode. It was really nice. Everybody was really friendly. We were out in the countryside, like my husband said earlier, so there were not many foreigners out there. So you'd often be walking down the street and there'd be little kids walking with their grandparents, and, you know, kids would turn and point at you and stare and like, wow, an American. And, you know, so it was, you know, we were a specialty. We were a bit of a treat. And so, you know, it was, it's always interesting to see someone from a different place and someone with a different culture. And so we were often treated very, very well.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think it's a shame. Only 5% of the United States has a passport.
Really?
Yeah. And that really explains why it's so easy to bomb other countries.
That's terrible. People, yeah. You got to get out there and travel. It's a beautiful world.
Yeah, exactly. But that isn't that a staggering statistic? 1 in 20
wow.
people has the ability to leave the country. It doesn't mean they've actually used their passport. Huh. But yeah,
I am surprised.
Yeah.
That's sad.
And I couldn't. I mean, I had a friend. I lived most of my adult life in Maine, and I needed a ride to Boston. And I had a friend, and I said, I lived about 12 miles north of Portland. I said, is there any chance you could drop me off at this one particular bus station that was just south of Portland, you know, so I could just hop into Boston? And she said, I have never been south of Portland.
Ah.
You know, I mean, and it's that misunderstanding of really how provincial. She's a wonderful woman, fabulous person. Didn't see any reason to go any further. You know, she was a fishing community person, and, you know, her family had made their living on the coast, and they really didn't get the point of it. And when I went to the Hurricane Katrina relief and the ugly American response to some of the people who were stranded there, why didn't they leave? And you find out that 80% of people in New Orleans have never been out of Louisiana. And 40% of people in New Orleans have never been out of New Orleans.
Wow.
I know. And that is the role of poverty in mobility. You know, if you don't have the $70 for a bus ticket, because you don't have the $70 for anything, you know.
You know, there is something to be said for home and having a place like that. But just, it's phenomenal how your horizons are broadened when you see other cultures and other places and other ideas about the world. It's just amazing.
I went down there as a journalist, and one of the challenges that they had was these families that were literally living in the neighborhood that their mother and their grandmother had lived in, these families were being expected to evacuate in parts. A mom and the kids could leave, but what about Grandma and Aunt Betty, who had always been in the neighborhood? You know, and so when they figured out in the triage of moving people out of New Orleans and getting them redistributed around the southern half of the country, they would call, you know, a church would call and say, we'll take in a family. And they'll say, well, will you take 12 people? Because we really want to send mom, the two kids, grandma, Aunt Betty, and we want the whole family to be able to go because they've never been apart. You know, so I'm ever since I knew you were going to come in here, and I'm thinking, all right, you lived in Fukushima Prefecture. I always want to get that right. And so you weren't in the danger zone, but you got these refugees. So I was thinking, what was that like for this rural area? So kind of like a county, right?
Prefecture is similar to a county.
Yeah. So let's talk about when the tsunami hit. Did you have warning? Were you frightened? Did you know it was happening, or did you hear about it after the fact? You know, what was the first few days like?
Well, the earthquake came first, and that, I mean, that, you know, that causes the tsunami. And we were far from the coast, so we had no idea about the tsunami for at least several hours, maybe a day.
Did you feel the earthquake?
Yes.
Oh, yes, quite strong.
Yeah, 8.9, right, or 9.0 it ended up being. Yeah.
Yeah, they say what we felt where we were was a 7.
Wow.
And it was really strong. It just, you know, it starts shaking and then it like jumps up and then it keeps shaking and it jumps again and it just kept jumping up and being stronger and stronger. And I thought, how much stronger can this get? I mean, I had no idea that the earth could move like that.
Really? Was it frightening?
Not at first. I was in a small grocery store, and when everything started shaking, I just started pushing things back onto the shelves so they wouldn't fall on the floor.
Huh.
But the grandma that owned the shop, I saw her in the doorway with her husband holding on to the door frame, and she was frantically waving at me. And I realized maybe I should be scared. So I held my bag of eggs in one hand and started to walk towards her, and the floor just jumping up under me, under my foot, was making it difficult to get to her. But then we stood in the doorway for at least 3 minutes while it kept just shaking everything. And then when it subsided a little, we crossed the street and just kind of hung out for a little bit because everything was, you know, everyone was just kind of shaken.
Well, a 9 is like 1,000 times a 6.
Right, it's exponential when they go up on the Richter scale.
Right, it's not like, oh, well, we had a 6 Thursday. You know, it's nasty. So did you have aftershocks and then did stuff break? I mean,
aftershocks, it didn't even seem like it stopped for that, like, a day. It was
really
ridiculous. But we were far enough from the epicenter where the shaking was, it was considerable, but I didn't feel threatened that a building was going to fall down or anything. So I actually was more excited than anything else. I thought it was neat to be in
a big earthquake.
In a big earthquake.
So where were you at the time that it happened?
I was in the office of our employer. It actually was graduation day in the junior highs that we were working in. And so we had had graduation in the morning, and the kids were dismissed after graduation. So with lunchtime, most of the people had been dismissed. So we were actually back at home, even though it was the middle of the afternoon on a Friday. So we were, Ashley was in the grocery store, and I was in the office of our employer. And the shaking started and just did not quit and did not quit. And we didn't realize, you know, since none of the buildings were falling down where we were, quite the extent of it. But we were assuming that wherever the epicenter was, it was going to be felt stronger than what we were feeling where we were. And then when we finally got calmed, when the ground calmed down enough that we could go back into our apartments, we turned on the TV and we saw the devastation from, you know, all the pictures that you guys saw here and the news of, you know, stuff just collapsing and the waters coming in with the tsunami. And
how long did it take the tsunami to hit after the earthquake?
I think it was minutes.
Oh, really?
I really don't remember very well.
So it shook the water the way it shook the ground, and that made...
The epicenter was in the ocean.
And what happened is one plate slipped below the other one and caused a great chasm in the ocean, and so the water flooded into it and then surged back toward land and created just a wall of water that came, I think at the farthest point, 6 miles inland.
Now, Brett was telling me that Brett, the producer who gets spoken of but never heard from, which is a shame because he's funnier than me. Brett was telling me earlier that he had seen a video he hadn't seen before of like 17 minutes or something that were just the most frightening 17 minutes he's ever seen, where the guy is watching the water come in and it doesn't stop coming in, sort of like it doesn't stop shaking. And so then he keeps trying to get to higher ground, and then it sucks everything out. You know, it just, which, you know, I saw videos similar to that, but not 17 minutes worth. You know, it just sounds as though, and from the huge masses of stuff that have been coming on the western coast of North America, it took an awful lot of stuff with it when it went back out again.
Right. Yeah, my feeling of excitement was very quickly sobered up when I turned on the TV and I realized this is really bad.
So I should have looked this up. I don't know how many people died. I could look it up real quick while you tell me how many kids did you guys get? I mean, you get refugee kids. Did you get, when we were at Katrina, we got kids who lost their parents. We got parents who couldn't find their children. You know, what was it like when the refugees started to arrive?
Well, the first, within just a couple days, I think maybe a day after it happened, we had refugees start coming through our town. They stayed in our school buildings, which it's a little different in Japan. Even after graduation, there's 2 weeks of school left for the grades that don't graduate. And all of that was canceled. And then the refugees came into the community center and all of the schools in the area. I think that the number's about 7,000 refugees came through our town alone. Some stayed, some passed through heading somewhere else. And of course, Japanese families live multi-generational, so there were grandparents and aunts and uncles and you know, larger groups of people that all traveled together.
Similar to what I saw in New Orleans.
Right,
yeah.
Right, they used a lot of military transport, so we actually had a lot of, like, big buses coming through, and there were helicopters flying overhead, and it almost felt like a war zone for the next couple of days. We would see Humvees going by.
Yeah. It says that there were 30-foot waves, and the earthquake was 15 miles deep. In the earth.
Right. Yeah, the quake happened quite quite deep.
Yeah, the entire island of Japan moved, I believe, 8 feet to the east.
Wow. The confirmed death toll, 15,883 people.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Just amazing. And, you know, we don't even have time to go into all the news now out of the reactor, which we did a couple of weeks ago, and we'll do probably again next week, because that just keeps, that's just the story that just won't get better, you know, about the water and then the containment chambers and all that stuff. But these kids, they've literally, many of them lost family members, I'm thinking, 15,000 dead, and they're coming to school, and what became normal for them? Was school the only normal thing? Were there religions that were moving around? I mean, that was the other thing at Katrina. Every church was there, and they weren't allowed in the shelters. I was in a shelter that had about 8,000 people in it. The churches were not allowed in the shelters. Physically, space was just not available. So the churches all set up on the lawn around the shelter, and then people would go to the tent they wanted to go to for their particular. Was there anything like that?
There were a lot of humanitarian aid workers coming in from all over the globe. It was quite impressive, but really where we were was not hit nearly as hard as the other areas. So we had all these refugees coming out through our area, which is essentially directly inland from where the nuclear plant was.
Mm-hmm.
But the aid workers were all flooding into the coast. So whatever was damaged in our town had to be put on the back burner.
Huh.
And we didn't really see that until we were evacuating from the possible fallout. And we were near the airport, and we saw all these different groups coming in and heading up to where we were departing from.
So 54 nuclear reactors in Japan, and one of them pretty severely hit by the earthquake and the tsunami. And then how long was it before they said, uh-oh, you kids might want to go?
Our boss called us all in for a couple different meetings. And the first one, you know, he explained that there is a large problem here, and that the wind is shifting away from us. So for at the moment, we're not in immediate danger. That our water comes from the opposite direction, and, you know, we don't have any, we're not in immediate danger, but that he would evacuate us, you know, if that was necessary. And it didn't take, I think, more than 2 or 3 days before he decided that we needed to head out. And so they drove us all down to Tokyo and put us on airplanes.
Hmm. And is that when you left, or did you come home for vacation and go back?
That's when we left. They said, well, they sent us home, and we were home for a month and a half. And then they said it was safe to come back, and so we came back and stayed for 2 more years.
Right, oh, yeah. Wow. We really didn't know if we were going to be able to return or not.
Yeah.
So as we were packing up our bags, we were hoping that we still had a job.
Yeah, yeah.
But you had no idea until...
Were you afraid of the nuclear part?
The radiation did have us nervous. Like I said, we are directly inland from where the plant is. So if it had been just the earthquake and just the tsunami, which is, you know, plenty,
yeah.
We probably would have been fine. But once the nuclear plant started going off, we initially had all these refugees bussing through our area, and then the town turned into a ghost town.
Hmm.
And everybody just packed up and took off. And our boss said, we're going to have to get you guys out of here because we have to figure out what's going on. And we didn't know if we were going to come back ever again or if the whole area was just going to be quarantined.
Now, you told me the other night, I already know the answer to this question, and it shocked me. The U.S. government was right on top of making sure you were okay.
Yeah, we got an email about a month after it happened. We were in the U.S. and safely with our parents, and they wanted to know if we were injured or needed to be evacuated. Yeah, so I wrote back, no, we're fine, thanks.
My mom's a little sick of me, and can I do my laundry at the White House? Wow. So I mean, I have a friend who is in the Navy, a young man, and he was deployed there. I don't know what he did when he got there. You know, it's one of those things that they're not allowed to tell you anything. But you hear about the U.S. government's response to it. I also, though, read some of the translated Japanese newspapers' accounts that said that basically the power company was sending the information on the power company's disaster directly to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and bypassing Tokyo. And when Tokyo found that out, the U.S. involvement got very limited because they were really kind of miffed, and justifiably so, that the U.S. government was learning about what was going on in Japan before the Japanese government was. And allegedly basically said, when I was reading these newspaper stories, that they basically called the head of TEPCO or whatever it is and said, your office is now in my office.
Yeah, TEPCO, you know, I'm not a big fan. they did a lot of things that, you know, nobody agrees with. And as far as I know, yeah, the Japanese government eventually said, like, look, you know, we're in charge now. But I don't like the way that much of that was handled within the company.
Essentially, it was a communication breakdown across the board, but understanding a little bit more about Japanese culture, it makes more sense the way that saving face and honoring mm-hmm. different people is such a huge, huge thing there. And they have to go through these proper channels, and at the same time, they don't want to say something if they're not absolutely sure. And as these gears turn horrifically slow in some cases, it just... the disaster and the emergency demanded that, you know, these things go through, and the word was not coming out.
Huh. Wow. Jane Ashley, thank you for taking the time to come in and hang out and tell us your story, and maybe you can come back and tell us some more sometime, because I could ask you questions all night. This is amazing stuff. All I know is that the one thing about that reserve that you speak of means that maybe Anthony Weiner and Mark Sanford would behave themselves a little better if they were Japanese politicians. Not sure. Just thinking maybe. I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Attention, citizens. I have received inside information revealing that global terrorists are targeting us again. Their target is not Washington, New York City, or even Disneyland. Rather, it is Concord. You know, in New Hampshire, the state capital. Even though only about 43,000 people live there, Concord apparently has strategic significance, for the local police, fully backed by the city council, are preparing for a horrific terroristical assault. Specifically, they're seeking $258,000 from the Department of Homeland Security so they can gird themselves by purchasing a Lenco Bearcat G3 armored vehicle. This bold stand to defend the homeland was revealed by the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union, which obtained a copy of the grant request. Actually, it is not Al-Qaeda terrorists that have Concord's police gearing up for war, but, quote, the domestic type of terrorists. Really? In Concord? Yes, insists police, referring vaguely to daily challenges and warning that the threat is real and here. Who are these domestic demons? The police finger two groups, Occupy New Hampshire, whose violence has mostly been in the form of doing litter pickup days, and the Free State Project, a libertarianish outfit trying to convince 20,000 like-minded people to move to New Hampshire. Neither group is armed or dangerous, and both are committed to nonviolence. Yet the police claim they need a Bearcat G3 to respond to terrorism involving, quote, chemical, biological, and radiological materials, as well as explosive gases. This is Jim Hightower saying the most explosive gas in this case is coming from police officials who have tagged their own peaceful citizens as terrorists. And the real threat to our security is the Department of Homeland Security, which keeps shoveling our tax dollars into the militarization of police forces all across the country. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
No power without accountability. First thing we're going to get to the bottom of. Hi, this is Pat LaMarche, and I'm on the Rick Smith Show. Rick has taken the night off to do something fun. I'm absolutely certain of it. Something fun and delightful with his kids. You know, Governor Paul LePage up in Maine, he's a rocket scientist when he's not, you know, doing everything else. And he was accused of being a racist after he told the NAACP to kiss his butt when they invited him to an MLK Jr. breakfast. And he said, I'm not a racist. My son is black. And it turned out his son was actually a caddy that he had gotten and brought home with him. I don't think you're supposed to get and brought home black people anymore. I think that's been passe for a while. But just to make sure I'm not right, or I am right, I have brought in Hugh Magby. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Pat. How you doing this evening?
I'm doing great. Hugh is a fabulous civil rights leader and a first black producer, of television producer in the United States?
Yep. That's right.
What year was that?
That was in 1968. What a year, Pat. Oh, my goodness.
1968. We need it back again.
I don't think so.
Well, I'm just saying. It seems like we've turned all Trayvon Martin. Everything's been turned back to... You know, lynch him.
Well, I would remind you that 1968 was the year that we lost Martin. It was the year that we lost Bobby as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was the year of the Chicago riots and a lot of turmoil in this country.
People aren't rioting, even though we have a greater disparity in wealth right now than we had in 1968.
We can always hope.
We can always hope. So I'm going to jump all over the spectrum this half hour with you, mostly because my thoughts are so scattered, but I apologize for that. But I want to talk about Paul LePage and his ridiculous comments that President Obama doesn't like white people. I would say he doesn't like Pakistanis and might go along with that. I think that drone bombings are abysmal and horrible things. But as far as the president being a racist, and that's his motivation. Well, you wrote an op-ed piece in Retort, but why don't you just give us your thumbnail sketch on what you think was motivating Paul LePage to say that?
Well, Paul LePage is cut from the same cloth that many racist demagogues in the past have been cut from. He makes outrageous statements to shore up his base and to ensure that... folks know, in the words of Louise Day Hicks, another wonderful demagogue from the state of Massachusetts, we know where he stands. Clearly Paul has carved out this particular niche for himself.
So, hey, the racists know who they can vote for.
That's right. That's right. And as you are well aware, he won the governorship with about 36-37% of the vote, because he was in a three-way race and the Democrats and progressives split their vote. So he was able to capitalize on what I call a redneck voter registration drive, and was able to propel himself into the Blaine House in 2010.
Well, just real quickly, that is the same thing that happened 4 years before when the Democrat won with 36% of the vote. And it's the game is rigged, and the Democrats and Republicans won't change it because they take turns being the beneficiary of it. And there are things that could be passed in the Maine legislature and other places, that, such as, you know, ranked choice voting, that would stop that from happening. But because it might work for our guy next time, they keep this broken, defective system that has now yielded Paul LePage.
That sounds like sour grapes from you, eh? Did you run for governor of Maine?
I did, but it's just a fact. Why would the Dem? I have testified in support of ranked choice voting numbers of times, voted ought not to pass unanimously out of the Maine state legislature every single time until Paul LePage was elected, and it's because it worked for the Democrats.
Well, you know, I'm having fun with you, Pat, because yes. I do agree with you. I think that ranked choice voting would indeed be a more accurate reflection of the voters' will in the state of Maine.
Well, so the problem is we've got this, you can win with a plurality system. It's the same system in the United States. On the federal election side, we wouldn't have gotten Abraham Lincoln without it. That was a four-way race that he got about 27% of the vote on. We wouldn't have Bill Clinton. So a lot of people got less than the majority support, but a totality of the power.
Yes, I think that is correct. I think, you know, whether you want to change the rules or not is a reasonable question. But I think that in the particular case of Mr. LePage, his pretty blatant appeal to the racist elements within the Maine electorate have pretty much appalled me and many Mainers. And I think we all sort of recognize now that he has been playing to his racist base, and he has been successful so far at doing that because of the silence of the majority.
And that was part of the point that you made in the piece that you wrote, which we will post on the Rick Smith Facebook page, Rick Smith Show Facebook page. You made the point that the silent ones could very well be in agreement with him.
That, I'm afraid, is true. This is a nonpartisan or a bipartisan silence. I have been a county chair in the Maine State Democratic Party, and I have been in the state party upper echelon, the state committee, for about 10 years. And during the time that I've been there, I have encountered racism and benign neglect. Barack Obama was selected during our Maine caucus in 2010. Many Maine State Committee members were very upset because they really felt that, and this was a direct quote, a black person simply could not win the presidency of the United States, and this was a disaster for the state of Maine, a disaster for the U.S., for the National Party. Clearly they were wrong, but their comments and their words certainly hurt at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also, I should add that the Maine Democratic Party has been ordered by the National Democratic Party to initiate a outreach program for minorities and other people. And I was part of that effort as well. And it was very much put down by the senior members of the Maine Democratic Party. So clearly it isn't in anybody's interest in the state of Maine, which is the whitest state in the union, to encourage minority participation. It pisses off Bubba.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm back in the day when I was in television, I think, and I was working, maybe I was already in radio, but I was bartendering a couple of nights a week to make a little extra cash. You know, single mom, that old story. That old tale. There was a local town councilor who had written a letter condemning the Jews that were working down on Main Street, their businesses. And somebody got a hold of this letter and handed it over to the Bangor Daily News. The Bangor Daily News printed the letter. So that night in the bar I was bartendering, and this city councilor walked in and proceeded to get earlobe deep in whatever he was drinking, and said, "I've destroyed my career." And I said, "Well, sadly, maybe not." And he said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I wouldn't be surprised if your constituency was very racist. And you're not going to lose, or anti-Semitic, or whatever the terminology is you want to use, you're not going to lose a single vote from an awful lot of people and you'll be reelected. And he said, do you really think so? I said, I'm horrified, but I don't think outing yourself as a creep is going to cost you necessarily an election. And you know what? He got reelected.
Sure enough, the smart money is on being able to not piss off Mainers who may have racist tendencies. That's why when I was chair of the Maine Democratic Knox County Democrat, no one would seem to want to have their picture taken to me with me. They kept on running away from that. They didn't want to be identified with minorities in the state.
So what is going to happen with this struggle? What is the, and then I want to move on to the celebration tomorrow in Washington, D.C., that you recall what it's commemorating. You recall 50, and, you know, you look a lot younger. But you recall what happened 50 years ago. But what's going to have to happen? Are we going to have to call racist racist? Because, you know what, I was doing a lot of it during the Trayvon Martin stuff, and I was getting people saying, how dare you?
Oh, boy, I got a lot of that in the comments in the Bangor Daily News. In fact, I got a lot of personal attacks and a lot of racist comments, and frankly, I'm a big boy and can take all of that. Mm-hmm. I think that in the state of Maine, there's a real problem in leadership, and that leadership starts at elected officials. My op-ed was in the Bangor News on Tuesday and on Wednesday, and so far, not one elected official has come and addressed the issues that I pointed out in my op-ed. Not one, whether it be Democrat or Republican. There needs to be a concerted effort to retort this kind of racism. The state of Maine needs to talk about it. They can't sit here and sweep this under the rug any longer and say it doesn't exist. Paul LePage is getting votes on this stuff, folks. He's making votes and getting his base just squared away and ready for this next election. And we're all sitting around here saying, well, he's such a bad guy. Oh, gee whiz, oh, poor Paul LePage. And at the same time, he's a very canny politician. He knows what's going to build his base.
Well, what is it? 17 states have stand your ground laws.
Yeah.
This is, Paul LePage is only the most coarse of these figureheads. He's not in, by any stretch, alone in this divide and conquer, split us on every level, economics, you know, economic status, race, religion, you know, every way that we can be divided, we're supposed to be divided, and that's the plan, you know.
And yes, it is, and you know, it's a fact of life in American politics. I just don't think that most Mainers thought that it would devolve to this point and be as blatant and as obvious as it is. And I'm always hopeful, and I always have great faith in the people. And I suspect that although Paulie set this table, he's going to find himself on the menu.
You're using old Rick Smith. I use an old Rick Smith line. He, by the way, you're listening to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Pat Lamar, filling in for Rick. He says, if you're not at the table, you're going to be on the menu.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, so tomorrow, March on Washington events, 50th anniversary celebration, and you were a young man of 19.
19 years old.
The original date was August 28th, which is sometime in the middle of the week. But
yes.
It is 50 years since Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. led approximately 250,000 people in the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Oh, my God, 50 years and we still need jobs and freedom.
Well, actually, the title of this particular march is not Jobs and Freedom. That was 50 years ago. We are now marching this time for jobs and justice. And that seems to be a very important thing in the wake of Trayvon.
Absolutely in the wake of Trayvon. I would also argue in the wake of Chelsea Manning.
There you go.
But we don't want to talk freedom then, do we?
Well, freedom is always a great thing, but I think that most black folks will agree with you that the kinds of concerns that we had in 1963, where we were being firebombed, tear gassed, water hoses put on us, and some of us would disappear at night, never to be seen again. That fight looks as if maybe it's over. Then again,
so you
gotta look at the Supreme Court,
yeah.
And you gotta think about voting rights. Is this fight really over? Take a look at North Carolina. Do you think this fight is over, Pat?
Good point. Did you see that Attorney General Holder has decided that he's going to go after Texas?
Yes.
I said in passing that actually all of the ballot access and ballot gerrymandering, all of that has actually been done inside of a Texas woman's vagina, just so that the Texas legislature can inspect it one more time.
But, goodness.
Well, you heard, of course, they have ridiculous draconian choice laws, but they also are the ones who pulled the women over and did roadside cavity searches.
Yes, I do
know
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty obvious violation of someone's civil rights and privacy, if you ask me. But then again, the whole war on drugs seems to be that kind of violation.
Well, again, we're talking about sexism and racism in absolute spades. So if this rally tomorrow, will there be 250,000 people? I mean, everybody's talking about it. Is it going to be a success? Is it going to make a difference? I'd like a difference. Somebody accused me the other day of being completely powerless. All I do is stand and hold a placard. I'm like, I don't even do that.
Oh, that's not powerless. That's not powerless. That is standing in witness for justice and freedom. Don't you ever feel bad about doing that?
Oh, I don't feel bad. I'm just saying this was the comment. Was it? You know, you don't accomplish anything.
We are accomplishing a great deal by gathering together. Getting in a car or a bus or a train or a plane and going to D.C. tomorrow morning, and at 8 a.m. that march will be assembling at 600 New Jersey Avenue in Northwest, and folks are going to be marching at 9 a.m. sharp. There's a whole list of wonderful speakers, and the march will culminate with a speech from Barack Obama. Barack Obama is the living legacy of the march in 1963.
Has the president done enough for the poor people of color in this country?
Well, you're really opening up a can of worms here this evening, aren't you?
It's my job.
Okay. Okay, Pat.
You know, because I was working at a homeless shelter when the first stimulus package came out, and son of a gun, we got people housing. We saved people from getting evicted. We paid electric bills when that was all that they needed. You know, there was actually money and compassion and staff available. We could hire people to get things done. And then all of a sudden, everybody acted like it didn't work. I'm like, wait a minute, the stimulus is working. And all of that money got taken away. And all of these programs that were very much so helping, you know, my shelter was probably 50% people of color. My community isn't, right? I mean, this disproportional poverty, you know.
Yes. I've worked for anti-poverty agencies in Boston, Vermont, and in other places as well. And during the war on poverty back in 1972, 73, 74, I probably would tell you right now that, Pat, you have done more to help poor people than the president has. And the reason is, it's because the president has not addressed Wall Street's predation on the American public.
Mm-hmm. I haven't either, by the way. I've tried.
Well,
don't let me
you
in.
You ain't alone there, honey. You know, that is my big, real effort right now in push is to get Congress to act. We are under assault daily from Wall Street and its predation. And this is affecting black people, and it's affecting white people. I live in the state of Maine, where 250,000 people in the winter go to bed hungry and cold because of the high price of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Price of oil is being controlled by speculators on Wall Street, and that is the only reason it's so high. That's the only reason your gasoline is so high. The only reason your heating oil is so high. If they got out of there, your heating oil bills would be about $200 a month, $100 a month, $50 a month. Your gas would be around $1 a gallon. These people have sucked the blood out of our economy and suck the blood out of the middle class and the poor. And the major inflationary issue is oil.
Mm-hmm. So tomorrow, I'm thinking if I could go, which I really wish I'd go, I definitely would have donned a hoodie because I do think I'm still grieving. You know, I'm awful lot of people have died in the world through time. You know, I'm still grieving Davis from Atlanta, from Georgia. What was his first name? Troy Davis.
Troy Davis.
Who was innocent and executed. I mean,
it's a pretty awful time we're living in right now. We have a completely corrupt Congress that is totally beholden to its very wealthy donors. One needs only go to the Federal Election Commission and take a look at your congressmen and see where they got their money from.
Mm-hmm.
They are not your friend.
Okay. So you start off, though, by saying that it's not 1968 and that's a good thing. And you were badly beaten as a young black man just for being a black guy. So you, I'm sure, must be able to empathize with how frightening it is to be Trayvon Martin. And you can't stand your ground with your fists. And have you gotten more respect because you got older? Have times actually changed? Or is it the same thing and someone would take a punch at you still if they could?
My gosh, Pat, you should see the responses that I got from my op-ed and the article that appeared in the Bangor Daily News today about my spending the original march watching TV with my mom, who was dying of cancer at the time. I received, and I know you know that, really horrible, horrible personal attacks about myself and my mother. I couldn't believe it. So have things changed? Boy, you'd be really hard-pressed to ask me that question, especially living here in Maine. Now, if I were in another part of the country, I'd be among more minorities who had more power, who had more money and more influence and more positions of power within the power structure. But here in Maine, this is the whitest state in the Union, and it's pretty lily white. So it's pretty hard for a minority to even get any traction whatsoever in being able to get themselves visibility within the system.
I have a pet peeve, and that's people who share, like, the sidewalk and don't say hi. You know, I'm like, I'm a human being. I'm walking by you. We're sucking the same air. You know, just say hi. Just wave. Just nod. Just, you know, wink. I don't care. You know, acknowledge this other person because maybe we'd all be nicer to each other if we didn't pretend a human being wasn't 18 inches away from us. But I now very selfishly say hello to absolutely, I mean, go out of my way to make eye contact and say hello to every young black man that I meet because I don't want them to think I am that absolute idiot white guy. Gal, right? I might still be an idiot white person. I just don't want them to think I'm just, you know. And so I'm walking with a white person the other day in Pennsylvania, which has thankfully many more people of color than they do in Maine, and it's a wonderful thing to have some diversity. And I walk by these three young black men on skateboards, and I did my, you know, hello and greeting and my just wanting to share the fact that we're in the same space. And this white guy, who doesn't think he's racist, made some sort of a comment. And I said, I want you to actually soul search right now and see if you would feel differently if those three guys were white. If those three kids on skateboards were white, what would your opinion of them have been? And if you're going to, and I want you to honestly think about it. And he was like, oh my God, I'm a bad person. I said, yes, you are.
No, he's not, but that's okay.
But he is.
You're talking about something that has to continue in this country. We need to have a dialogue on race. Now, my problem with the state of Maine is, okay, you're an elected legislator. You know there's a problem. You know that the governor is playing you when it comes to race. When are you going to have the courage to stand up and talk about this?
Well, when that happens, will you let me know?
Yeah,
hey, also do us
a... Might have to dig me up, Pat.
we're out of time, but if you'd also just post on my Facebook page today's story from the Bangor Daily, and I will make sure it gets on the Rick Smith page.
Oh, thank you so much, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Great talking to you, too, Hugh. Hugh Magby, the very first producer, black producer of television in the United States of America. And, yeah, sadly, it happened in the last 60 years and not 150 years ago when it should have. Well, I guess they didn't have TV. Anyway, I'm Pat LaMarche. I'm filling in for Rick Smith. He's off tonight, and we'll be right back.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Governor Scott Walker's Capitol Cox arrested one person Thursday for merely clapping along with a solidarity sing-along song at Wisconsin's Capitol. The daily noon hour protests started in 2011 during the Wisconsin uprising that was protesting stripping away of collective bargaining rights for public workers. A federal lawsuit over First Amendment rights at the sing-along at the Capitol goes to court for trial in January. Two Democratic Wisconsin state lawmakers stood with the solidarity sing-along on Thursday. Representative Sandy Pope was one of them.
I just feel I have the duty and the obligation to my constituents to be here and observe what's happening as this administration chooses to try to suppress the people's voice. I want to be here to see it. Also, do not want this administration to feel that it can intimidate and silence the voice of the people.
Wisconsin State Representative Diane Hesselbein had a sign that said her office hours were right now during the sing-along.
I've been here the last few weeks, actually with my constituents, letting them express their opinions about what's going on in our state capitol. The Constitution speaks for itself. People are allowed to come here when they want to.
Holding up big letters that said unintimidated, the singers filled Wisconsin's rotunda with songs of protest.
Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand.
Labor singer-songwriter Ann Feeney, on a national Summer of Solidarity tour with United Steelworker activists and others, stood with the Solidarity singers and got a very warm reception as the singers sang their rendition of her song, Have You Been to Jail for Justice?
People didn't boycott the bus in Montgomery for a weekend. It took over a year of constant struggle. And I know that Wisconsin knows how to fight back. And you're doing it, and you're doing such a great job, and it's such an honor and a thrill to come back into the Capitol and see that you're still here. You're still here. So I'm so glad to stand in solidarity with you.
Lars Pripp is an ex-Marine member of Veterans for Peace. He carried a sign in Wisconsin's Capitol Rotunda that said, Political Prisoner Number 52.
I was arrested two times at the Capitol for being at the sing-along. And I'm here because it's a fight against fascism. The Capitol Police are taking political prisoners. I want to see people in the streets.
John Schultz is a retired United Church of Christ minister from Madison, Wisconsin.
And I'm here as a Christian pastor because I think that there are serious justice issues involved here. It's a moral witness, but it's informed by my faith and who I am as a Christian person. To free the oppressed.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I feel my head to the new constitution. Take a bow.
I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. This is the Rick Smith Show. Welcome to the program. My friend Diane Nyland, she is the founder and the executive director of Hear Us, and she has offered to take Paul Ryan, Congressman Paul Ryan, for a ride with her to meet homeless children, homeless children and their families. There is now a MoveOn.org petition for Paul Ryan to take this advocate for homeless children up on her offer. If you would like and you have the time and you can, please get a chance to get over to MoveOn.org. Her organization is called Hear Us. We'll put a link on the Rick Smith page how you can just click on it and sign that petition so that Paul Ryan will put a little bit of his time where his mouth is and meet the poor that he says President Obama has no idea who is poor, as though he does. And well, that's kind of a joke. Sorry, Paul Ryan. There's the complete and total lack of belief that you have any better solution than the solutions that, well, aren't solving anything right now. We do need better solutions. And if people would talk to the advocates and the poor, I think they would get those answers. There's a group out that just gives money directly to poor people. It's a not-for-profit organization. They get the money, they give it to poor people. It's a perfect idea. Who knows how to spend the money? The poor people. Now, of course, people who are punitive and punishing think that a poor person can't be trusted to make the right choice if you gave them something. We have so much love to give in this country, and we just don't spend enough time doing it. But someone I love who joins me occasionally on the program when we want to talk about all kinds of stuff, Steve Kramer. Hey, Steve, welcome to the Rick Smith Show.
Hi, Pat. Good to talk to you again.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. You know, if Paul Ryan takes her up on that, takes Diane up on that offer, that might be the first children he's talked to outside of his voucher school.
How many vouchers do your parents have? What do you mean you live in a dumpster?
Yeah.
Hey, Chelsea Manning, just so people know, your background is that you're a computer guru guy who knows all this stuff and may even, to some degree, understand the idea of what WikiLeaks had. I mean, people...
As a matter of fact, I was following WikiLeaks well before they got on the radar here because they were doing a lot of the same stuff, except they were doing it to other countries. You were finding out about, you know, what the Nigerian government was doing to cover up the abuse of the oil companies in that country. Funny enough, the fact that the United States had nothing to say about WikiLeaks at that point. But later on, they decided that WikiLeaks was sort of an enemy of the state.
Right, because they get documents that, and oh, for the love of God, if one more person picks a fight with me on Facebook about the fact that, and why would anyone fight with me?
Especially on Facebook.
Really? I mean,
yeah.
Where all of you come in like a tide that rushes in to drown whoever's after me. But, I mean, the people are saying, well, look at the aftermath of what, of the leak. 760,000 documents and, I'm sorry, the Valerie Plame leak, thank you, Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby, we documented that caused murders.
Absolutely. There was a huge leak regarding that, and it basically traced back to Valerie Plame's group, a CIA group, and their charge was that they were in charge of tracking weapons of mass destruction around the globe. So, yeah, there was a much more serious matter where that happened because essentially it outed an entire group of people and we lost the ability to track things like nuclear material for a short while, which I would think would be something that would definitely have some kind of an impact. But we had Scooter Libby, a guy who I share a nickname with.
That's right.
And he ended up getting pardoned pretty quickly out of that whole matter.
Will Chelsea have a pardon in her future?
Almost absolutely not. You know, what we're looking at from Obama, we recently had a situation where a couple of people from our political party, the Green Party, who tried to address Obama during the speech that he made, and basically Obama laughed it off and said, yeah, that's America for you, and went on as his own business. And I don't see it actually happening because of the concerted effort by the Obama administration to go after not only Manning, but other people of conscience who have come forward and have revealed that there are problems with the country and how they're going ahead and managing these things.
and I asked this of Senator Mike Gravel when he was on earlier tonight, is really what happened the fact that Manning ran up on stage and pulled the United States pants down and were just embarrassed that he could, that this is a private. This isn't a lieutenant colonel. This is a private that had the power to abscond with 720,000 documents or whatever it is. 720,000 documents. What the heck are people writing?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. These were all State Department cables for the most part. And his job was to essentially vet these things, make sure that they were all recorded. Well, of course, he, you know, had that power to go ahead, record them, and make sure that he had a good collection thereof. You know, the interesting thing about what was going on with Private Manning at that particular case, actually, he was demoted down at PNC. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is, and one of the names that we don't hear a lot about, is a man by the name of Adrian Lamo. I don't know if you've run into that name. This is the guy who Manning found, sought out on the Internet. He is an old line hacker, somebody who was doing it. He actually got very famous in 2003 for hacking into the New York Times database. And Lamo said that he would actually protect, and this is literally in the chat logs that were published, he literally said, I'm both a journalist and I'm a minister. I will keep your confidence in either case. And what Lamo did, essentially, when he was confronted with that, was he just took it and took it straight over to the FBI, saying that there were, you know, enough problems and he thought that people were going to get killed and everything like that. Well, A, nobody has been documented to be being killed as a result of any of this. And B, Lamo snitched. He went to the FBI. He also went to Wired Magazine and an editor by the name of Kevin Polson. Polson took the chat logs, published parts of them, and then hid the rest and sat on the rest for a little over a year before revealing the rest. And one of the things that they revealed was that Lamo had tricked Manning into trusting him. So it wasn't our vast, you know, intelligence community. It wasn't any of the infrastructure that the NSA has put up. It was one guy who literally tricked him.
It was a snitch. It was the same thing as the dress, Monica Lewinsky's dress.
Yeah, pretty
Somebody
much.
Told in confidence, and then what's her face? The chick goes and says,
Linda Tripp.
Yeah,
yes.
Thank you.
Linda Tripp was the person. As a matter of fact, Linda Tripp lived near me.
Oh.
But my sister knew her daughter, Allison Tripp.
Allison Tripp, what a great name. So, yep. So we've got this snitch who rats out his friend or the guy who thinks he's his confidant, which, you know, people would argue all's fair in love and war, you know. You snitch, but then you hear something. In fact, did you ever see the movie The Priest?
I did.
I loved that movie. And
yeah. There's
a point where something is confessed to the priest, and then the priest, you know, the priest technically isn't supposed to know that. That's the priest is just the conduit between the confessor and God, and the priest is not technically supposed to know it. And as he uses for an example in the movie, if you confess to poisoning the altar wine, I should still say mass and drink it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, not only that, I mean, this is somebody who is actually coming out of that same community. Lamo had done some things that were extremely questionable and had gotten in trouble with the FBI.
So did he get himself out of trouble by ratting on Manning?
It's believed that was the arrangement that was made afterwards. Lamo himself had gone on, I think there was a fellow by the name of Chet Lau who was part of an operation within the FBI, and I have just remembered the name of it. But Chet Lau basically came out and said, afterwards, that this was a man named Adrian Lamo doing his patriotic duty to make up for what he did to his country. Well, it wasn't the country, it was in the New York Times, but the point of it was that this was probably a planned arrangement in getting this guy over, and he absolutely did snitch.
So the argument about this happening because Bradley Manning was becoming gender confused, and now she has said she'd like to be called Chelsea, which I think and hope people respect.
Mm-hmm.
was, I mean, people are just jumping on all this. And I think, personally, I think that is setting back the whole trans movement about 50 years, because it even seems as though her defense attorney was trying to make it look like that was a mental illness.
Yeah, the defense attorney was using a number of things to try essentially to say that this was a product of disordered thinking. Because really the defense attorney was backed up against the wall. There was a lot of things that the government had as evidence in their case that really he couldn't get to because of a matter of national security. It was a matter that a lot of these things, even though they weren't classified, most of them had the lowest level of classification involved, as opposed to, you know, when we were talking to Senator Gravel earlier, what Daniel Ellsberg did, he had a document that was top secret. It was absolutely the top level of classification.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was not given a lot of in access to that information in order to build a defense. So he had to do the best he could with what he had, which was to try to go ahead and say, well, this was somebody who was talking to, in this particular case, Adrian Lamo also, about the fact that, you know, he had some gender issues, identity issues. And this was, you know, he accidentally sort of spilled some of this stuff as it was going. Well, as it turns out, it was really, when you took a look at the chat logs that Wired magazine finally released, it really was a matter of conscience the entire time. And he was essentially tricked into trusting the wrong guy with this information.
Yeah, they say if you're going to keep a secret, you can't tell, so you can't tell anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, shifting gears maybe a little over to Snowden, who we haven't mm-hmm. heard much about in a week or so, aside from the fact that now I guess the United States government's trying to tell the Russians that he's gay. You know. The latest news on his stuff and his NSA leaks is The Guardian was told, you had fun with all these different pieces of information, and now we want them back.
Right.
What?
Mm-hmm. They were actually subject to a raid. British police raided the offices of The Guardian, took hard drives and similar equipment, and either blanked them or took them with them, essentially saying that these were now state secrets and you can't have them. I don't know. Maybe they should hire some gay guys. Apparently, being gay makes you a really good spy. I don't know how that happens. But you know,
I think being gay might make you really good at everything.
Apparently, I don't know.
I'm to the helmsman on the Enterprise.
On Star Trek. Absolutely.
It's like it's definitely Orwellian. I mean, the cows are already out of the barn. Why are you making such an idiot thing as to go and get the information that's already been published?
The thing of it is, when you have the sort of mentality that creates these crises in the first place, you don't really have a firebreak in your mind somewhere to go ahead and say, wait a minute, this is crazy. We need to turn it off. You know, we had this sort of thing similar to what we had in the Cold War, where you started having doctrines like mutually assured destruction, we'll have to go ahead and have our own weapons so that if they launch their weapons, we'll launch ours.
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up in a number of cases having some real near misses because, you know, honestly, people are going to be human and you know, accidents are going to happen. Mistakes were going to happen. In a sense like this, what you've got is a number of people thinking that information is so sacred and so central to the existence of a country that you end up putting way, way, way too much emphasis on it, and suddenly it becomes that this information is so secret that not even certain people in the government can have it. You know, we still don't know. In a number of cases with the NSA documents, there were senators and congressmen trying to get information on what was being leaked from each other, and they wouldn't tell them.
That is amazing. It's got to be something that's just meant to keep us busy. because we're not talking about the important stuff. Honest to goodness, Snowden got out of the airport. I'm happy for him. Lord knows anyone who's been stuck one night in the airport that was feeling for that guy. But we're not talking about, you know, the sentencing today of the guy who massacred the families in Afghanistan and the fact that, you know, I'm glad there's no death penalty on the books for this guy, but there was one for the Muslim who shot up Fort Hood or Bragg or whichever one it was, one of those.
Fort Hood, in Texas.
Yeah. So, you know, we've got this double standard that the average guy can figure out, you know? And now, because Syria is buying weapons from the Russians,
Has been for a long time.
Yeah, and has been for a long time. We're talking about going in, and that's the whole reason to tell anybody they're buying weapons from the Russians, so we can go in.
Well, there's that. There's also the fact that in this particular case, Assad has used those weapons, and they're chemical weapons in this particular case.
Like the ones that we gave Saddam Hussein when he gassed the Kurds.
Precisely, but these were ones that he got from the Russians. And now we have a situation where President Obama said very clearly that that would be the red line that you would not cross. And, well, they just went ahead and crossed it, which is, it's obvious as to why they're considering this as a battle for their survival. So now we're in a situation where a number of countries, Britain, Turkey, France, have all said that they needed to go in and wanted to go in militarily. And now we've got the president sort of tap dancing on his earlier statement.
I already have too many friends who've been deployed 6 times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this callous use of our lower-income people who find the military as their only option. I meant to say this to Mike Gravel earlier. You know, the battle cry for HW was, we won't have another Vietnam. This won't be another Vietnam, when he did the first Gulf War. And you know what? We don't have another Vietnam. We don't have a draft. We have people who get sucker punched into joining the military. We don't have any accountability. We don't have impeachment of a president or now two who wage war illegally. Guess what? We don't have Vietnam.
Yeah. It does sort of all, in a sense, fit together. I mean, what we're talking about is with the, you know, secret information and what we have dealt with as far as Edward Snowden is concerned is you have a superpower that is acting unilaterally, and they are acting without any let, leave, or hindrance. There is no accountability. They can essentially do what they want. There is no rule of law. When you have that kind of impunity, you do tend to sort of look at things in, dare I say, an imperial fashion. And that includes the use of military, perhaps in situations where our national interests are not clear or not even present. We had that with Iraq. We had that with Afghanistan. We even had it with Libya. We now have a situation where it could happen in Syria, and you've got a very, very confused and terrible situation there, where there are multiple factions. Many of them are guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity, not just President Assad, but many of the factions within the opposition, which are far from unified. And it's a real mess. And, you know, you can argue about going in on humanitarian grounds, but in a similar situation where we would have something such as, for example, happened in Sierra Leone in West Africa, there was no cry for the United States to go in there. There was not even a strategic target. It didn't have strategic resources. But suddenly it happens in Syria, and now we've got a global situation on our hands that we might have our American troops being drawn into.
And we don't, it just makes me so sad. Real quickly, Egypt, the second revolution, they've now only had 2. I keep trying to remind people that France had 5. You know, I mean, they kept having to redo that revolution thing over and over. I mean, if you go to those years between 1789 and like 1840, they had like 12 flags.
a number of them. Yeah. And you know, we might not even be counting things like the Paris Commune, which was just in Paris. It was one city doing that.
Right. So democracy, especially when you're making it yourself, if we're going to believe that that's what's happening in Egypt, is that they're fighting to make their own democracy, it's not a cake mix.
Right.
It takes a certain amount of everything that's going on, and it seems to me like the United States just refuses to pull back and allow a little bit of this organic change to happen.
The position of the United States in a lot of cases has been we are the world's exporter of democracy, apparently because we aren't using it here. but basically the idea is you can have your democracy as long as you pick the right guys. We saw that with a number of places. We saw it in Chile. We saw it in Iran with Mossadegh. We saw it in the Palestinian Authority, even, you know, in the early 2000s. So, you know, this has been a situation where, again, we're acting with sort of an imperial motive, an imperative. And it does get us into situations where we would really particularly not like to be in there. We're particularly backing the wrong person. We're riding the wrong horse, and it does come back to bite us in the end almost all the time. You kind of look at the world and cross your fingers and hope maybe they'll end up doing it the way the British did it, where they just gradually started spinning off some of these territories and as part of their empire. And even then, they had real problems in India, so, because they really were kind of blinded by the racism of the whole thing in that particular case.
Well, Howard Zinn said that you can't have a truly imperialist nation if you don't have the third world at home. And I think that the people from the United Kingdom, the leadership of the United Kingdom, took one look at that and said, yeah, we're going to have way too many resources extended where the sun never sets on the British Empire, or we're going to have to pull our resources home and have things like health care.
Exactly.
And that decision was made correctly, probably easily, because they had us to take over the ridiculous imperialism of it all.
Yeah, you know, it was the sort of situation where I think World War II, in a sense, was a wake-up call for a number of allied nations when they started looking and saying, you know, really, this whole idea of letting our government just, you know, do their imperialistic thing and have colonies all over the place and run them the way we want them rather than by the rule of law. Maybe that's not a great idea. We just saw what happened with Germany. We just saw what happened with Italy. That's not a great idea. Let's see what we can do as far as fixing some of that.
Right.
You know, and some nations didn't quite get the memo on that one.
Namely us. Now, real quick, one last little topic that I just think is delightful.
Okay.
Now, pretend for the sake of argument that it's August 22nd and you've decided that you're the CEO forum of Raleigh, North Carolina. All the CEOs from the state are all going to get together and you're going to get a keynote speaker who's going to come in and just energize the base. He's going to be a famous Republican, a noble conservative, happens to be Colin Powell. He comes in, the Governor McCrory, introduces him. Governor McCrory sits down. And Colin Powell rips into him for being racists. Can you imagine how much fun that was?
Unfortunately, you got somebody in front of the CEOs who was willing to tell the truth. And that always happens, doesn't it? Nobody wants to hear the truth.
It was beautiful because they just passed all those new voting restrictions, making it harder for the poor, disabled students, and minority voters to cast their ballots.
Yeah, similar to what they had in the early 60s.
Absolutely. And so he stood up and said, I want to see policies that encourage every American to vote and not make it more difficult to vote. It immediately turns off the voting block that the Republican Party needs. These kind of actions do not build the base. It turns people away. You can say there's no voter fraud.
Right.
You can say there's voter fraud, but if there were voter fraud, how could it be that widespread and not be and be undetected? He just said, boom, snap.
I tell you,
Pat, there's going to be a lot more moments that you will want to pop some popcorn, sit back in a comfortable chair, and watch the Republican Party over the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
This is going to be extremely interesting because we've got a situation where over the past several, well, really decades, over the past several elections, they've been cultivating this sort of a out-of-control populist base, which has manifested itself in the Tea Party, as it is right now, and they've been playing on that whole idea. If you remember Ronald Reagan, when they did something called the Southern Strategy, he had a guy by the name of Lee Atwater, and they were really going down south and courting that Dixiecrat vote from the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And that Dixiecrat vote was essentially a racist bloc down in the south. And they cultivated it very successfully and used it to win elections. Now it's starting to come back, and the whirlwind that they've reaped is starting to come back on them because that bloc has coalesced, and it's still going. And if anything, it is saying that the current Republican Party is not radical enough. It is not racist enough. You know, they're not going ahead and doing all of the terrible things. They're not being completely obstructionist in the way that they're just partially obstructionist in the way that they're handling their governmental duties. So you had a situation now where you've got a number of people who are trying to sort of steer control back to what the Republican Party likes to do, which is, you know, talk to CEOs and rich guys and give a lot of tax breaks to them. And then you've got this very radicalized and immobilized base that is saying exactly the opposite. They want to go ahead and see them, you know, just like Slim Pickens in Riding the Bomb Down.
Exactly. That is the perfect image.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve Kramer, thank you so much for taking some time to chat up politics with
My
me.
My pleasure, Pat. Always good to talk to you.
Always wonderful. Hey, I'm Pat LaMarche filling in for Rick Smith on The Rick Smith Show, and we're going to be right back.
Prepare a moment for the homeless or the poor. Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the gold cat dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Attention, citizens. I have received inside information revealing that global terrorists are targeting us again. Their target is not Washington, New York City, or even Disneyland. Rather, it is Concord. You know, in New Hampshire, the state capital. Even though only about 43,000 people live there, Concord apparently has strategic significance, for the local police, fully backed by the city council, are preparing for a horrific terroristical assault. Specifically, they're seeking $258,000 from the Department of Homeland Security so they can gird themselves by purchasing a Lenco Bearcat G3 armored vehicle. This bold stand to defend the homeland was revealed by the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union, which obtained a copy of the grant request. Actually, it is not Al-Qaeda terrorists that have Concord's police gearing up for war, but, quote, the domestic type of terrorists. Really? In Concord? Yes, insist police, referring vaguely to daily challenges and warning that the threat is real and here. Who are these domestic demons? The police finger two groups, Occupy New Hampshire, whose violence has mostly been in the form of doing litter pickup days, and the Free State Project, a libertarianish outfit trying to convince 20,000 like-minded people to move to New Hampshire. Neither group is armed or dangerous, and both are committed to nonviolence. Yet the police claim they need a Bearcat G3 to respond to terrorism involving, quote, chemical, biological, and radiological materials as well as explosive gases. This is Jim Hightower saying the most explosive gas in this case is coming from police officials who have tagged their own peaceful citizens as terrorists. And the real threat to our security is the Department of Homeland Security, which keeps shoveling our tax dollars into the militarization of police forces all across the country.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
I got no-
This is Pat LaMarche. Rick Smith taking his regular Friday night off for the summer to spend some time with the kids, so I'm filling in for Rick. Hope he's having fun. And with me right now, a voice of authority in the world of news. Such a nice change after the last couple of hours. Victoria Jones. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. How are you, Victoria?
I'm great. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Okay, so I just think the irony of the military convictions today, both coming out today, is kind of fascinating in a tragic way. I mean, two stories of two horrible tragedies, the Fort Hood shooting and the Afghan civilian massacre. But isn't it kind of interesting that the decisions came out today?
It's really kind of weird that they both came out on the same day. It really is. I mean, it's pure coincidence. And they both are, you know, they both seem to be meeting out justice. One of them, of course, the case isn't finished. That's the Fort Hood case. Monday they go into the sentencing phase. They found Major Nidal Hassan guilty in the Fort Hood massacre. That was, of course, a massacre in 2009.
Now, could he get the death penalty for that?
He can get the death penalty for that. The jury of 13 senior army officers who are all combat veterans will all have to agree on that in order for that to take place. And even then, it's very complicated. There hasn't been an execution in the military justice system for 52 years, and the approval of an execution of a military officer has to get a presidential approval.
Is that the Private Slovak?
I don't know who it was 52 years ago. Yeah. I don't know who it was. But it's very complicated, and there are an awful lot of appeals. So, I mean, it's really unlikely that it would happen, first of all, or happen anytime soon. But it's what he's angling for.
It is what he's angling for. It's what he would prefer.
Oh, yeah, that's what he wants. I mean, he put on almost no defense at all, really. I mean, he didn't even try. And in fact, even though he defended himself, you still have lawyers assigned to help you with the legal bits. And the lawyers went to the judge and said, take us off the case because we can't ethically do this because he's not trying to defend himself. And
why did he plead guilty?
Because he viewed it as his mission to kill as many soldiers as he could as part of a jihad to protect my Muslim brothers from American soldiers. I don't know. Huh. I don't know.
So he thinks he's innocent of a crime, so he's pleading not guilty, but he doesn't want to defend himself in our kangaroo court. Would that maybe be?
I think along those lines, yes. Huh. He also says if he dies by lethal injection, he would still be a martyr.
I guess if you're down to the point where you're quibbling over whether or not this still makes me a martyr. Oh, no, throw stones at me. Is that what he would need otherwise? I mean.
Oh, yeah, no, he's very quibbly about that because that came out he leaked that during the trial. And he has said that in an interview with a mental health panel that evaluated him.
How could anyone think he's sane?
They think he's quite sane.
I don't know about you, Victoria, but I just think somebody who wants to be martyred and thinks that that's a reward has lost all their marbles.
Oh, I think you can be quite gay and want to be martyred. I mean, I think it's a particular life choice. I think you can be quite sane and quite bad.
This is where I would wax into my... If your religion's got you thinking that way, maybe you're sane, but your religion's nuts. That not picking on Islam or any other faith, because I know plenty of I would say Christians, I don't know about too many other denominations, though, who also think martyrs are cool. You know, I don't know. Anyway, so the Afghan civilian massacre, now, that gentleman got life in prison.
He's got life in prison, no possibility of parole. Yes.
He also could have gotten the death penalty and they decided against
it? No, he couldn't have gotten the death penalty.
Why?
For this. Because he pleaded guilty deal to avoid the death penalty.
I see. Wow.
And, he didn't apologize right up until the very end, until the sentencing phase. And the language that he used when he apologized, this is somebody who massacred 16 innocent Afghan civilians, mm-hmm. people asleep on their blanket, young girl screaming and crying for him to stop beating her father, and then he just massacred her, a widow left clutching bits of her husband's skull, things like this, and did one village, then went back to reload and went back and did the other village,
right.
Said, I'm truly, truly sorry to those people whose families got taken away.
Wow, that is kind of very bizarre.
Yeah.
He's not crazy either.
I don't know whether he's crazy or what this one is. I mean, this one, of course, his lawyers say he's got PTSD and any number of things. The prosecutor says he liked murder and he liked the power it gave him.
Wow. I was brought up differently, I guess.
I was just brought up that you don't do that.
Yeah, me too. I like power. Okay, so, you know, get a fast car.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was brought up. Or get a good, nice pair of boots.
Right. And do a strut.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the world would be such a better place. Okay.
So those,
I mean, if I were moving chess pieces around the world, both of those stories would upset me for a bunch of reasons, just as far as the message we send other people. The guy who massacres all you Afghan innocents, we just took the death penalty. And I don't believe in the death penalty, but, I mean, I believe it exists. I don't think it should. We took the death penalty off for that guy because he said, hey, yeah, I did it, and I'm happy about it. But we left the death penalty on for the guy who thought he was sticking up for you.
Right, and, you know, the Afghan massacre, we actually had to halt combat operations in Afghanistan after that, and we couldn't even go into the village and deal with the forensics because we couldn't get near the villages because the uproar in Afghanistan was so great. Mm. I mean, this was like a huge outrage. No, it's totally messed up, you're right.
I want that woman who talked the gun out of the hands of the guy in the elementary school to run for president.
I do, too.
I want her to run everything.
Yes.
My gosh. She just talked to her about herself and how she understood that things weren't always going to go so good, and sometimes she had a bad day, and she made him think of her as a human being.
Yeah.
What a brilliant, wonderful woman. Okay, so budget battles. Almost as stupid as any other topic we could talk about tonight.
Yes.
These guys, they're like fighting over marbles like the marbles belong to them.
Yes, they are. They are fighting. But they're fighting over different pieces and where the pieces should go and there's different ones are fighting over different bits. You've got in the Senate, you've got one game going on, and then in the House, you've got another game going on. In the Senate, there's actually going to be a meeting, at least of about 8 senators next Thursday with the president to talk about the budget in a fairly grown-up kind of way. I don't know if it will go anywhere, but they're actually going to talk and try and start thinking about how to figure something out. I don't know that it will go anywhere, but it's a conversation. In the House, well, I don't know that we're having a conversation in the House. In the House, it's about let's defund Obamacare or no, we're not saying we want to shut the government down. We're saying if we don't defund Obamacare, well, then the government would shut down.
I'm not thinking that so bad anymore.
Well, a lot of
shut the government down for
a lot of Democrats are starting to think, well, if they want to go that route, good luck to them.
Yeah. You know, these guys always vote their own raises before they have these fights. They always make sure they got their raises, and then they start these fights. And it's just,
that's true.
It's so infuriating. Yesterday was the was 1996, I believe, that I call Bill Clinton the best Republican that anyone ever voted for. Bill Clinton eliminated effectively for what had been welfare and replaced it with welfare reform. I worked with the homeless for years and years and years, and the changes were and are stupid. But I'm just thinking, you know, that was following the government shutdown when that they were able to sort of leverage this move to conservatism because people just wanted the government to start working again. And I always fear that once again big hiccup to the right will happen every time they manage to show how dysfunctional they are.
It's always a risk.
Mm. Okay, so BP is being picked on. They're paying too much money for killing 11 people and despoiling the Gulf of Mexico and contaminating everybody's shrimp yields. But
yeah,
what is this whining?
BP's whining about a lot of things. BP's got a lot of things going on right now. I mean, I'm talking about one story. There's actually two stories going on. But the one we're focusing on is that it's launching this PR offensive. It says that it's being built for fraudulent damages related to the Gulf of Mexico oil spill 3 years ago. It says that the process has been rife with abuse, and its CEO is calling the process absurd. And it says it's being overly generous in rewarding businesses and individuals who suffered no damages from the spill. Now, there's no doubt that some people have, you know, tried it on and have got fraudulent damages, but the overwhelming number of people were damaged. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that they've got no grounds to stand on here. They say, we remain committed to paying legitimate claims, but we did not agree to pay for fictitious losses or for claims that are based on fraud or tainted by corruption, and we're being taken advantage of. Well, experts say, a Loyola University New Orleans law professor said they've got no room to complain because this person says that their complaint is based on the fact that they undervalued the claims. Apparently what they agreed to, and it's astonishing they
agreed
to.
So they did the math themselves?
Well, they agreed to a settlement with no ceiling on payouts by the company. And they also didn't agree to a geographic limit on where claims could be made.
That's spectacular.
Yes.
That's great. You know, I remember driving from Ohio to Maine the weekend that Katrina hit. And I remember gasoline tripling. When it was impossible that the gas that was in the gas stations in that weekend had been delivered that weekend.
That's right.
But I don't remember BP saying, we're not going to be opportunists on this calamity. We will keep the price at $1.10 because Pat LaMarche has to drive from Oberlin College where she dropped her son off back home again. And I never got that memo. So it's hard to weep for these guys.
It's always hard to weep for these guys.
My goodness. Okay, Barbara Boxer wants Vladimir Putin to chill out on the anti-gay stuff.
She does. She's not happy about it. Not at all. She wrote to him today, and she said that laws like a homosexual propaganda ban are an affront to fundamental principles of equality. And she also told him that these laws violate the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which Russia is a part of. And she urged him to repeal those laws that restrict rights of LGBT individuals in Russia. She said, I cannot stay silent while your country works to put in place deeply discriminatory laws and policies undermining the rights of LGBT individuals. And she also said she was deeply concerned about the upcoming 2014 Winter Olympics. And she said she expects Russia to not discriminate against any LGBT athletes or spectators from the U.S. and other countries.
You know, I can hardly wait for Comedy Central to get a hold of this.
It's
just going to be
spectacular.
First of all, I wonder if Barbara Boxer is going to write the same thing to the people at Leavenworth about Chelsea Manning.
Probably not.
So it only works when you're just throwing stones at Vladimir Putin. But second of all, I mean, really, we have most favored nation status with a whole pile of countries that execute gay people.
Yes.
Barbara Boxer, is there a reason that she's decided to start writing to Putin? She's seen his fishing videos, hasn't she?
probably the bear wrestling video too.
It sounds like she's just trying to get his attention. So he's not going to show up at the Olympics, maybe? Well, not
oh,
him, but his athletes?
Oh, he's going. I'm sure he's going. Yeah. And he's banned rallies and demonstrations during the Winter Olympics, too.
And, you know, I don't know what gay propaganda is. Is that where people stand up and yell, I'm equal?
I think it's just talking about it.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, one last thing. And I have, you know, I've been working on trying to get people from, quote, unquote, the military-industrial complex, for want of a better term, but somebody who is going to tell us why NSA spying is at all justified. And, I mean, I had a golden Rolodex at one time. Nobody wants to come on the radio show. It's like my Rolodex has turned to dust. Why can't anybody just call a spade and say that this NSA stuff is just plain unconstitutional, bad, wrong, blah, blah, blah? We don't need it.
Well, some people are saying that the NSA stuff's bad.
I mean, I just haven't been able to get anyone that had sort of the air of authority to, I mean, they don't want to give the information back, right? I mean, did they just make the Guardian, like, burn everything they had?
The Guardian chose to destroy its own computers rather than hand over the stuff.
Wow. Well, how can they even have to hand over the stuff?
Because it's a different system. I mean, they came in apparently and said, okay, this was after they'd published.
Right.
The men from the government came in and said, okay, and this apparently is all the words they used. Okay, you've had your fun. Now give it back.
That's amazing. They tried to do that with the Pentagon Papers, too.
It's astonishing.
Yeah, ridiculous. Well, Victoria, it's always a pleasure. I hope that you have a fabulous weekend. Have you got any wonderful plans?
You know, they're just going to sound lame.
Well, then you'll fit right in with Brett and me. A lame weekend all around. Victoria, have a great one.
Okay, you too.
Thank you so much. Of course, Victoria Jones. And I'm Paola Martian for Rick Smith. We'll be right back.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The steel strike of 1919 was called the Hunky Strike because most of the workers were either first or second generation immigrants from Eastern and Central Europe. Up until the end of World War I, workers had benefited from shorter hours, better pay, and the promise of union recognition. Once the war came to an end, the mill owners pursued anti-union open shop policies and other cost-cutting measures. During the strike, there was near total suppression of all civil liberties. Major work issues included the 12-hour day, the 7-day work week, scores of workers being injured and maimed, union recognition, and poverty wages. Mary Harris, better known as Mother Jones, fought tirelessly throughout her life for social justice and human rights as a labor leader and a worker advocate. On August 20th, while visiting striking miners in Homestead, Pennsylvania, home of U.S. Steel's famous Homestead Steelworks, she defied injunctions against public gatherings and addressed 5,000 striking workers and their families. This speech led to her being arrested and jailed for giving an unauthorized speech. When brought before the judge, she was asked who had signed her permit to speak at a public gathering. She answered, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. As the strike went on, Mother Jones, the grandmother of all agitators, gave many speeches to rally the workers. One speech in Chicago was described by a spy for the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division as the foulest and most profane that can be imagined, teeming with ultra-radical suggestions. Welcoming the spies, she would invite them to the front of the crowd so they could report her words accurately. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Let my dad come on, you know how it works when he come home from World War II. How the art's just a scrap and rubble. Said them big boys did what Hitler couldn't do. Yeah, these mills, they built the tanks and bombs that won this country's war. We sent our sons to Korea and Vietnam. Now we're wondering what they were dying for. Aaron Young's time.
I love Bruce Springsteen. They were dying for money. My sweet Jenny, I'm I'm Pat LaMarche, filling in for Rick Smith. Just a few minutes left to the program. It was so wonderful to have Senator Mike Gravel on, especially with playing that clip, Brett. You know, the man, when he read the Pentagon Papers into the Congressional Record, and if you go to YouTube, you should take the time and go watch Senator Mike Gravel read the Pentagon Papers into the Congressional Record, thereby saving Daniel Ellsberg from charges of treason. Didn't save himself, though. He had to defend himself. But when he's reading them, he told me that he had gone to Walter Reed Hospital earlier in that week. And he had met with kids who had lost an eye in Vietnam. They'd lost arms and legs. They had just had their bodies and their minds destroyed by the Vietnam War, and they were at Walter Reed Hospital convalescing. And he said as he started reading this diatribe about the lies that were told to cost 50,000 U.S. soldiers their lives, millions of Vietnamese people their lives. As he started reading this out loud, he couldn't get the thought out of his mind of these young men who were just broken so brutally by the war. And in the YouTube, as he's reading the Pentagon Papers, he starts to cry. And he's just such a great human being. Such a great man, now 83 years old, the man who ended the Vietnam War, the man who saved Daniel Ellsberg. I can't thank him enough for coming on the show tonight. He's just wonderful, and hopefully he'll be on the show a lot more now that Brett's got his phone number. So whenever they want a radical on the program, they can just give him a jingle for when Rick's here or when I'm here. A couple of stories in the news, just to round out the evening. This is, did you know that there's a Doggington Post? There should be a Caddington Post for you, Brett, but there's a Doggington Post. And so it's got all kinds of stories on the Doggington Post. Dogs, the dog voices from Arlington, just in case you want to have something a little bit local. What separates dogs from humankind isn't mental capacity, it's innocence. The innocence carries with it a clarity of perception that allows dogs to glory in the world and the wonder of creation in even the most humble seen in quiet moment. The combination of their innocence and their intelligence allows them to serve as a bridge between what is transient and what is eternal, between the finite and the infinite. That's Dean Koontz. And they have photos on Doggington Post of all these different dogs that they brought to Arlington National Cemetery. So, kind of neat. A story on there, though, that is just horrifying. A Texas police officer, canine officer, forgot his dog in the car. Well, it gets pretty hot in Texas. Officers at the Harris County, Texas Sheriff's Office are mourning the loss of their bomb-sniffing canine that died after his partner left him in a hot patrol car. According to reports, the deputy who served in the canine unit for 12 of the last 21 years became distracted upon arriving home and accidentally forgot that the dog was in the car. People do this, and when the policeman comes, they say, oh, my God, I forgot, and the policeman locks you up. Anyway, we'll put Doggington Post up on the Rick Smith page. Thanks, Brett, for all the help and all the fun. And Rick will be back on Monday, and I'll be back one day next week. This is Pat filling in for Rick on the Rick Smith Show.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy.